Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
The internet is full of half-truths and all-out lies. We've all seen them, and many people on social media complaining about it. Here's your chance to show improve. WorldAfropedia.com is a black-owned and operated encyclopedia. There are several thousand articles, but we need help. We can't uncover all the truth ourselves. So please, join us and become a writer, editor, or blogger for WorldAfropedia.com today. Every little bit counts. We owe it to the future generations to put the truth out there. Visit WorldAfropedia.com, the African-centered encyclopedia, a global database of African knowledge for the purpose of bringing about global African wisdom and understanding. WorldAfropedia.com.
Well, see again. The people who classify themselves as white are not happy with their appearance. Now, they've taught us to be unhappy about our appearance. You see, but they're very unhappy about their appearance. I think there's an article in the handout about a woman who was, white woman who was in Hawaii. And she said that being around the Hawaiian people and the Asian people, and she said she was tall and white and pale. She said she felt like a freak. And so then she started getting involved in genetic science.
Now we have the story of genetic editing, changing the genes of living things. A genetic editing tool can create mushrooms that do not turn brown. It can make pigs resistant to a disease. Christopher Houston of member station KBIA reports on why some people in the food industry do not want to use it.
The contentious fight over genetically modified food has put us in a place where we actually have junk food whose labels boast GMO-free. Food producers got to this point because they didn't earn public trust before sending out the first wave of GMOs 20 years ago. In an attempt to not repeat that mistake, producers are on the offensive for round two of the great GMO debate. It involves genetic technology called, bear with me here, clustered regularly interspaced short palindromic repeats, or CRISPR for short. CRISPR can turn off a gene within an organism, like the one that makes mushrooms turn brown. Scientists call it gene editing.
These new gene editing technologies like CRISPR are genetic engineering. And if this is genetic engineering, then call it that.
Skeptics like Dana Perls with the environmental group Friends of the Earth say food companies are trying to distance themselves from words like GMO and genetic engineering that have caused them trouble with consumers. That's why a group including the Pork Board, Monsanto, and Syngenta are joining forces to get ahead of the issue. Charlie Arnott leads the coalition and has three key strategies for getting consumers on board with CRISPR. Number one, it's not a secret.
Those involved in technology have to be willing to be much more transparent and much more engaged in a public conversation and dialogue in order to answer those questions, address the skepticism, and ultimately result in earning consumer trust in what they're doing in gene editing.
The coalition has members talking about the technology and its benefits related to animal welfare and the environment. They hope to build trust, which is number two.
If people trust you, science doesn't matter. And if people don't trust you, science doesn't matter. It only matters after you cross that trust threshold.
And that's the third strategy. These companies want consumers to know CRISPR is different from genetic engineering. CRISPR changes the way genes are expressed. It doesn't add genetic material from another species. Stop by the organic section of your local supermarket, and you'll find the coalition has an uphill fight.
Hi, what's your name?
Madeline Lemieux.
So you buy organic?
Most of the time.
And why?
I guess partially because I don't know what GMOs do.
So what if I told you there are mushrooms that don't turn brown? Is that something that you'd be interested in?
I would be leery. Things are supposed to decompose, right?
Those CRISPR-developed mushrooms already exist, but are likely a few years away from grocery store shelves, which food producers hope is enough time to convince shoppers, like Lemieux, that CRISPR technology is both safe and beneficial. For NPR News, I'm Christopher Husted in Columbia, Missouri.
Medical apartheid. The dark history of medical experimentation on Black Americans from colonial times to the present.
About one-third of African Americans say that they have experienced discrimination at a doctor's office or health clinic. More than one in five say they would avoid medical care because they're concerned about discrimination. Those are two findings of a new poll by NPR, the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, and the Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health.
The poll and considerable other evidence highlight a long history of distrust of the healthcare system by African Americans. One of the most egregious examples is the medical experiment known as the Tuskegee Study, a famous episode where Black men were left to die without receiving antibiotics. There have been others.
As part of our series, You, Me, and Them, NPR health correspondent Rob Stein looks at how distrust of medicine underlies a major problem: the relative lack of minority participants in medical research.
It's Sunday morning at the Abyssinian Baptist Church, a famous African-American church in Harlem. Hundreds of worshipers are streaming into the pews. The Reverend Calvin O. Butts III steps onto the pulpit.
Now may we stand for our call to worship. How good and pleasant it is when all of God's children get together.
He begins a powerful three-hour service filled with music, dancing, prayers, and preaching.
Here we go. Woke up. Woke up this morning with my mind.
But then about an hour into the service, Reverend Butts does something he's never done before.
I would like to introduce the Precision Medicine Initiative.
It's a huge new study sponsored by the National Institutes of Health.
It's now entitled All of Us. It is a landmark, longitudinal research effort that aims to engage 1 million participants of all ethnicities to improve our ability to prevent and treat disease based on individual differences in lifestyle, environment, and genetic makeup.
Why is this famous preacher at this famous African-American church talking about a big government medical study in the middle of Sunday service? Well, to understand why, I went to a clinic 30 blocks away at Columbia University.
Hello, Rob Stein. Nice to meet you. Anne Halliwell.
Hi, I'm Steve Halliwell.
The Halliwells just volunteered for the study. They'll spend the next hour in front of a computer tablet learning all about it.
If you complete the consent, the next step will be sharing your health data. We hope that this will help researchers find new things, including maybe the next big health breakthrough.
Answering detailed questions.
Have you ever had at least one drink of any kind of alcohol? God, yes.
Zero cigarettes per day. Electronic nicotine? No.
Getting their blood pressure, height, weight, and waist measured before rolling up a sleeve to give blood so scientists can get a sample of their DNA.
You can just make a tight fist for your place. Keep it nice and straight.
The Halliwells live north of Manhattan on the Hudson River, and they're white. And that's the problem. White people like the Halliwells are much more likely than Black people to volunteer for medical studies.
You okay?
Mm-hmm. Why? Well, the reasons are complicated. One is that Black people may not get the chance as often. They just aren't asked or have the time or money to volunteer. But another is that medical research has a long, troubled racial history. The Tuskegee experiment, when doctors let Black men die from syphilis. Henrietta Lacks, the poor African-American woman whose cancer cells scientists and drug companies used for decades without her permission. The abuses go on and on. So the National Institutes of Health has been working to overcome all of that, among other things, like getting help from the Abyssinian Baptist Church in Harlem.
Oh.
Back at the church, Reverend Butts is exhorting his congregation to volunteer.
This research is not like the Tuskegee experiment, and it is supported by some members of the Henrietta Lacks family. And it's not just for black people, by the way. It's for all ethnicities. So there are a lot of people participating. And you can bet your life that white folk are in this. They want to know what's going to keep them alive. And we ought to know what's going to keep us alive.
As the service ends and the parishioners file out of the church, they find a block party getting started on the street outside. At one of the folding tables lining the block, researchers from the NIH, Columbia, and two other New York hospitals are answering questions.
So what is this, though? You're doing research? Tell me about
it. So our goal, so it's really a unique program, and our goal is to get participants, a diverse range of participants. So we want women, we want minorities, we want everybody, but we really want women and minorities to participate in this community, of course.
Many people are enthusiastic, like Joanne Thigpen.
I can't wait for this program to start. I'm very excited about it for myself and my children. So I can't wait.
But some seem wary, like Deborah Fleming. She listens patiently, but then declines an invitation to sign up. I pull her aside to ask why.
Seem to be hesitating a bit.
As African-American, I know that sometimes these things are used against us, not to our advantage. So that's why I'm reticent about joining.
I heard the same sort of thing from Benjamin Vines Jr., who was enjoying the party down the street.
Reminds me of the Tuskegee type thing. And in my culture, African-Americans are scared of the doctor. They don't go to the doctor till the last minute, till we're almost on our deathbed, simply because of that. And
because of Tuskegee?
Yes.
At first, I thought it was only older parishioners who feel that way. But as the block party was breaking up, I found Hortensia Gooding. She's a grad student who lives in Harlem.
I see my friends mentioning Tuskegee all the time on Facebook. There's a lot of deep, deep-seated fear and concern that black lives don't matter and that the medical community really will harm people of African descent on purpose just for profit or just to help someone from another race.
For others, the reluctance has nothing to do with Tuskegee or Henrietta Lacks. Don't forget, the study is asking volunteers to give up a sample of their DNA. Here's what Clarence Johnson said when I asked him about that. He's 51 and drives a truck.
No, not my DNA. I can't.
Why is that?
Because I don't know what they might use it for. It might link me to something I don't want to be linked to. Any criminal activities.
So the question is, will the help of the Abyssinian Baptist Church and others be enough to overcome these deep suspicions and other obstacles that prevent minorities from participating in medical research? Rob Stein, NPR News, New York.
Meanwhile, Somalia continues to recover a massive bombing in Mogadishu that killed at least 358 people and wounded over 400 others. A roadside bomb exploded on Sunday, killing 11 people. The explosions come after the Trump administration stepped up a U.S. campaign against al-Shabaab in Somalia. In March, Trump declared Somalia a so-called zone of active hostilities, giving wide latitude to military leaders to launch airstrikes and ground assaults. In May, that led to the first U.S. combat death in Somalia since 1993, when Navy SEAL Officer Kyle Milliken was killed in an assault on an al-Shabaab radio station. In August, a raid by U.S. soldiers and Somali troops on a village outside Mogadishu left 10 civilians dead, including three children. For more, we're joined by two guests. In Detroit, Mark Fancher is with us, an attorney, frequent contributor to the Black Agenda Report. His latest article, U.S. Troop Deaths in Niger, AFRICOM's Chickens Come Home to Roost. Joining us via Democracy Now! Video stream from Luanda, Angola, is Horace Campbell, currently spending a year in West Africa as the Kwame Nkrumah Chair of the Institute of African Studies at the University of Ghana. He is a peace and justice scholar and professor of African American Studies and Political Science at Syracuse University. We want to welcome you both. Professor Campbell, let's begin with you. You're on the continent. You're in Africa. Can you respond to what has happened in Niger and put it in a larger context of U.S.-Africa policy right now?
Greetings from Luanda, and greetings to all the people who want peace. What is happening with the United States' presence in Africa is similar to the United States' presence in the United States itself. That is, the lives of African people do not matter. The United States of America is involved in a duplicitous war and terror in Africa when on the streets of the United States of America, black people are being terrorized. At the same time, the United States is in a dubious alliance with France that wants to instigate ideas about terror in order to save capitalism in France. So this relationship between the United States and France in what is called fighting war and terror in the Sahel comes 6 years after the United States, France, and Britain went into Libya to destroy that country because that country wanted to create the basis for the unification of Africa and an African currency. Last year, President Obama said that going into Libya was the biggest mistake of his presidency. Later in October of 2016, the British Parliament had a report that said that going into Libya was based on lies. The only government that did not respond was the French government that mobilized those who are called Al-Qaeda to fight against Gaddafi. The same French government that mobilized the so-called Al-Qaeda forces in the Mali, in Niger, is mobilizing within the United Nations to get African Union, to get five countries in Africa, Mauritania, Mali, Chad, Burkina Faso, and Niger, to support France, to get the United Nations to send millions of dollars in this so-called fight against terrorism. The challenge for us in the peace and justice movement is to oppose both the United States and France in this so-called war on terror. What the people of West Africa need is money for reconstruction, health, housing, employment, and changing the natural environment so that the millions of youth can get jobs. It makes no sense for the United States of America to be spending $100 million to build a base in Agadez, in Niger, where France has already a military base, and France is using the United Nations in this so-called multidimensional peacekeeping force in this so-called war on terror. What we need is for a massive campaign to get the truth about why these people are in Niger, Mali, and Chad, because there is no war and terror going on when they finance the so-called terrorists to overthrow the government of Libya.
Professor Campbell, if you could, you've talked about France and the United States and their role. Most Americans were not aware that there were this many troops, American troops, in Africa. But could you also contrast or compare the French role and the U.S. role to China's increasing role in Africa and the strategy that China is using as well?
Well, in the case of France and the United States of America, both cannot compete with China. In the case of Niger, Niger provides 75% of the electricity needs of France because it produces uranium. 7.5% of the world's production of uranium comes from a French company in Niger. In 2008 to 2010, China promised to invest billions of dollars in oil production in Niger. The president of Niger at the time, Mamadou Tandja, had accused France of financing those who were called terrorists. He was overthrown in a coup d'etat. Both the United States and France and other members of the European Union are opposed to the Chinese presence in Africa because we're in a country like Djibouti. The United States has 4,000 troops. China has spent $5 billion building a state-of-the-art port and has spent $10 billion building a railway from Djibouti to the capital city of Ethiopia in Addis Ababa. There is no possibility of the United States of America and Western Europe competing with China in Africa. Africans do not want this competition over their territory. What Africans want is a demilitarization of the continent and for the duplicitous role of France, the European Union, and the United States to end in this so-called war on terror. The African people want money for reconstruction so that in a country such as Somalia, every cent that is being used for fighting the war on terror could be spent in building schools, and then the police operation could be used against Al-Shabaab. We can only deal with terror when we demilitarize it and treat the extremists in Africa in isolating them from the communities of young people who are fed up with the alienation because there's unemployment and low standards of living for the African people.
Mark Fancher, the chickens come home to roost. Explain.
Well, the U.S. Africa Command is something that was created in or about 2007. At the time, it was clear from its design that it was intended as a way for the United States to use military methods to carry out its imperialist agenda in Africa without having to run the risk of suffering U.S. casualties. The idea was that U.S. military forces would be placed in strategic locations in Africa for the purpose of training, advising, and directing the armies of African countries, essentially to carry out missions for the United States. So it was a, you know, they could have their cake and eat it too sort of a situation where they could engage certain hostile forces in combat and not have to worry about U.S. troops dying. It has not worked out that way. We have just seen within the past month the fact that there are U.S. troops that are at risk as a result of this. It was inevitable. Anytime that you introduce violence into a situation that requires the construction of infrastructure and attending to the needs of the poor, you're going to run into this kind of thing. So it was, in a very real sense, their chickens coming home to roost.
Mark,
they did
Fancher,
not escape.
Can you talk about what the U.S. troops are doing right now in Niger? I'm surprised many a number of senators, although apparently they've been briefed several times this year, that at least 800 U.S. soldiers are in Niger right now. Can you talk about why a drone base is being built? Can you talk about where Agadez is, what they're doing both in Niger and in other places in that region?
Well, it's not just Niger. What many people also don't know is that this level of military presence can be found in many countries throughout Africa, most of them, as a matter of fact. Since 2007, the United States has been expanding its reach and has been planting small groups of people in various different locations, not always with what would be regarded as military bases, but as embassy-based operation centers where they carry out military training and different operations using African armies. So it's no different in Niger. And the use of drones is just an extension of the basic idea of carrying out reconnaissance missions and sometimes actual attacks without putting U.S. troops at risk. So this is very much par for the course. And I really think it's important to really understand what has happened in Africa over the last 10 years. In 2007, when AFRICOM was created, the presence of terrorists to the extent that we see them now, there was nothing comparable. The presence, if any, was minimal. What was going on in Africa at the time was that you had organizations like the Movement to Emancipate the Niger Delta, or MEND, which had engaged in very militant kinds of attacks on U.S. oil installations, breaking up pipelines, kidnapping U.S. Oil company and Western oil company personnel, and issuing a threat in 2006 that they could not guarantee the safety of either the facilities of oil companies in and about Nigeria and in that region, or the people who were sent there to work on them. It was at that moment that the United States decided that it was going to set up this special command, which was unprecedented for Africa exclusively. You know, you also see what was happening during that period was what they branded as piracy off the coastal waters of Somalia. These were fishermen whose waters had been contaminated by people who had come in and had plundered and raided their fishing facilities, and had made them unable to engage in a livelihood. And in retaliation, they began to attack those boats and ships that were coming through those waterways, which was a major international shipping lane. So these twin concerns about access to the coastal region in Somalia, the oil that was being produced in the Niger Delta and the Gulf of Guinea, those were the primary drivers for the creation of AFRICOM. And the more that the U.S. military established a presence in that region and throughout Africa, the more terrorism tended to grow.
Well, Mark Fanshawe, I wanted to ask you about another key event in the history of Africa, or the recent history of Africa, which was the U.S. participation in the overthrow of Gaddafi and the situation in Libya. To what degree did the total destabilization of Libya and the Libya is now, in that sense, a failed state, have an impact on the growth of extremism and terrorist groups in other parts of Africa?
Oh, it had a huge impact. And if you look at the infamous emails of Hillary Clinton, which are available at the State Department's website, you see an email exchange where State Department personnel are talking very frankly about their conversations with Sarkozy about his interest in overthrowing Gaddafi because he wanted two things. One, he wanted to eliminate the threat of a Pan-African currency, gold-backed currency that Gaddafi wanted to establish because he was afraid that it would devalue the franc. And he also wanted access to Gaddafi and Libya's oil fields. That was the bottom line for why they went after Gaddafi in the way that they did. And in order to do it, AFRICOM stepped in and played a major role in recruiting local forces within Libya to attack Gaddafi. They chose to establish relationships with some of the worst elements in Libya. In fact, one of the groups that they established a relationship with was one which, by its very name, said that its mission was to eliminate black people from Libya. And so they gave guns, heavy artillery, to all kinds of people in Libya with the hope and expectation that they would, you know, carry out this overthrow of the Libyan government and assassinate Gaddafi. That played itself out, but those weapons were still there.
Professor Horace Campbell, we just have 30 seconds. Your final comment in talking about what's happened in this latest attack in Niger. Also, five Nigerians were killed, not to mention what happened in Somalia with over 358 dead.
I want to follow up on the point about what happened in Libya and why the progressive forces must continue to press for a United Nations investigation in what happened in Libya. I spelled all of this out in my book, Global NATO and the Catastrophic Failure in Libya. What is happening in Niger is a continuation of what happened in Libya. France is in deep crisis. France has taken over as Under Secretary of Peacekeeping Forces in the United Nations. France tried to put a resolution through the United Nations Security Council to get more money for France in Niger, in Chad, in Mali.
I watched a white riot in Portland, Oregon on television the other night.
5 months ago, two young black women, one of them wearing a hijab, were on a light rail train in Portland, Oregon. A white man began yelling insults at them. When two other white men intervened, the guy harassing the women stabbed and killed the two men. Media from across the world descended on Portland. A few months later, as things gradually calmed down, the world's Roopa Shenoy visited Portland, and she found a city still wrestling with its past.
It's hard to remember how shocking the Portland murders were, probably because so many horrible things have happened since. But what happened on the light rail was stunning in its cruelty.
A tirade on a train ends in horror.
The victims are being remembered as heroes.
They didn't even know me. And they lost their lives because of me and my friend and the way we looked.
Oh, I was heartbroken.
And Ayokende was just down the street in her office at a collection agency when it happened.
And to be taken that way was so, I don't know, so savage.
People called the light rail murders a wake-up call. But Portland's had wake-up calls before. Many of the city's older activists told me the murders made them remember their first wake-up call nearly 30 years ago and wonder if they'd done enough.
The crime took place here on Southeast 31st early Sunday morning. Three black men, all from Ethiopia, were sitting in this car talking. When one left to head for his apartment, another car pulled up. Three young white men jumped out and began beating him.
That time, Ndayokende was also just down the street.
I was in bed and sleeping. It was early in the morning.
Her young son was asleep, too, when someone knocked frantically. It was a guy who lived a few streets away, who Kende knew because they were both part of the same tiny, close-knit Ethiopian community in Portland. She followed him outside and saw a pool of blood in the street. He told her it was their friend Mulugeta's blood, Mulugeta Sarah. Kende pulled out old photo albums and showed me pictures of Sarah at their party.
This is him when we're in the community.
Sarah is serious and thin.
And
he looks so young.
He was very young.
He was 29, and he worked at a car rental place out at the airport. That night, Kende went to the hospital to find out what happened to him. They asked her to identify his body.
His head was blown. His whole body was blown up. It didn't feel real.
It took a while for Kende to realize that what happened to Sarah had a particular significance in America because he was black, and the people who killed him were members of the white Aryan nation.
Yeah, losing Mulugeta was sad, but when it got big like that, it was something unexpected.
There were anti-hate protests and rallies and speeches and community meetings. Mulugeta Sarah became a symbol for people who identified with him, like Scott Nakagawa.
It felt incredibly personal to me. I felt immediately as if I was in danger.
Nakagawa was a young college dropout from Hawaii of Japanese descent. He worked at a homeless nonprofit and had been chased home by a truckload of white men who pummeled him with beer cans.
Portland police said there were no neo-Nazi skinhead groups here, and we saw them. They were, you know, in our faces.
Nakagawa joined a ragtag band of young activists who, by night, infiltrated Portland's blossoming punk rock scene where white supremacist groups were trying to recruit. By day, they organized out of an old warehouse they called the Matrix. There were squatters living in one corner and in another, an old printing press once used by Portland radicals.
There was an incident once when a small group of neo-Nazi skinheads came to our door and then started to try to chop it down with pickaxes. And the amount of panic inside the building was just comical. You know, I mean, all the men, myself included, were running around looking for something. When did they come in here? What do? We need to pick up a club. We need to find a baseball bat. We need to do something. But they were stopped by one young woman who had the presence of mind to simply open the second story window and point her camera out. And when they realized their pictures were being taken, they ran away.
They were all just silly kids, Nakagawa says. But they were part of an unprecedented network of Portland groups that called itself the Coalition to Protect Human Dignity. Together, they amassed evidence, like white supremacist newsletters and magazines, to prove to police that white hate groups were a threat. What remains of those archives is now kept at the Oregon Jewish Museum and Center for Holocaust Education. Steve Wasserstrom, a Coalition for Human Dignity board member, showed them to me and Scott Nakagawa. It was the first time Nakagawa was seeing the material in decades.
Oh, brings back a lot of memories.
It makes me feel old.
This is a free music magazine, and what you can see here is the Charlie Manson with a swastika on his head spewing blood.
Wasserstrom was a Jewish studies professor and one of the coalition's public faces. White supremacist leaders published his name and address, and Wasserstrom got graphic, violent threats. He went to the police, and an officer advised him to get a dog.
I'm supposed to go home and tell my wife with these two small children that these Nazis have threatened us. They know where we live. I'm a public figure, and I should get a dog. So, yeah, it was that didn't feel like it made me much more secure.
When we would call the police, they would often take a long time to show up, you know. I think because they just felt like these are just sort of people who are just trying to look for a fight, you know. I think briefly we were regarded, some of us, as gang members, you know, anti-racist gang members.
Police don't remember it like that. When I asked what it was like back then, Sergeant Chris Burley, Portland Police Public Information Officer, called the detective who investigated Seurat's murder for a firsthand account.
The city recognized that there was an immediate issue that was coming about involving hate groups.
From the police point of view, there was an overwhelming response. Oregon passed a landmark hate crime statute. Police found Seurat's killers, and the men were convicted. Then, the founder of the Southern Poverty Law Center, Alabama civil rights attorney Morris Dees, came to town with a novel new strategy to drain resources from hate groups by suing them. Dees sued California KKK Grand Dragon Tom Metzger, arguing Metzger incited the men who killed Seurat. Dees won, and Metzger was ordered to pay $12 million, at the time the most ever awarded in a hate case. Burley says during the trial, police protected the judge, jury, and Seurat's family 24 hours a day.
And recognizing that there was a likelihood that other hate groups could come to support those that had killed Mr. Seurat.
But as for tracking white hate groups in general, Burley says police can only investigate if a crime's been committed. So the Bureau couldn't always do what activists wanted.
As law enforcement officials, we might find the words offensive, but so much of the time what people say is protected by the First Amendment.
Things changed suddenly in 1994 when Timothy McVeigh bombed the Oklahoma City Federal Building. The FBI made white hate groups a priority. Nakagawa says within a decade, there was the perception the problem had been addressed. Funding for anti-hate groups slowed. The Coalition for Human Dignity collapsed. Nakagawa and other activists moved on to other organizations and other causes. Fast forward to May 25th, earlier this year. An African-American woman named Demetria Hester was on the light rail, going home from her job as a chef. A white man started yelling racial slurs. She asked him to stop, and he threatened her. Hester later told her story at a press conference.
It was 25 to 50 people on that train that did nothing.
She got off the train. The man followed her and allegedly hit her in the eye with a Gatorade bottle. Hester maced him. She told a police officer what happened, but the officer couldn't find the man who'd threatened her. That man turned out to be Jeremy Christian, the same man who, allegedly, the very next day, got on the same train line and committed the murders that put a national spotlight on Portland.
I should feel safe in Portland. I don't.
Looking back, Scott Nakagawa thinks what he and other activists did after Mulugeta Seurat's murder was important and had an impact. But he says they failed to be vigilant, and now it feels like they're starting from scratch.
We should have been more attentive, but this is the story of America, isn't it? We've done this over and over and over again. This is not the first or the second or the third time.
Tomorrow, we look at Portland's response to its most recent wake-up call. For The World, I'm Rupa Shenoy in Portland.
Carry me back to old Virginia. There's where the cotton and the corn and taters grow. There's where the birds warble sweet in the springtime. There's where the old darkest Harlem longed to go. There's where I labored so hard for old Massa. After day in a field of yellow corn, no place on earth do I love more sincerely than old Virginia, the state where I was born. Carry me back to old Virginia. There.
Brent Solomon got his hands on that video. He joins us now with the very latest. Brent?
We've decided to only share a portion of the video. Because we're talking about minors here, we're also blurring the faces of every child featured, as well as some of the graphic activity that was caught on camera.
Oh!
What's up with you and the blacks?
The viral video starts with the question, ever wonder what happens in the football locker room? It showcases football players from Short Pump Middle School simulating sex acts. Black players on the ground, other students on top.
What's going on?
A student types, quote, we gonna blank the black out of these African-American children from Uganda.
I felt sad for my child that he had to experience this.
This parent doesn't want to be identified to protect her son.
You see kids in the locker room forcing kids over the bench. You see kids on the ground thrusting on other kids. Making racial slurs as they're thrusting. You see the kids asking to get up and to stop and screaming.
That parent telling 12 what's also alarming, the behavior was allowed to go on as long as it did. I reached out to Henrico Schools, a spokesman saying the district is aware of the video, which is offensive and wrong. The district says it will take appropriate action.
If I was one of those parents and my kid was on the bottom of that pile, I'd be angry.
I took the video to Henrico supervisor Tyrone Nelson, who believes the school system should take action.
Are these kids playing around with? Or was this some type of racial situation? If it is young kids being held against their will and being sexually manipulated, then that's one thing.
Was it something that not everybody was okay with?
No, they were not okay with it.
Was he in a position to even really defend himself?
No. He had people that were straddling over top of him. Racism should not be tolerated. You should be able to send your kids to school and feel as though they are being protected and safe.
All right. While you heard the response from the district office, I took things a step farther, reaching out to both the school board chair and the board member who represents Short Pump. Since you elected them, we figured you deserve to hear their thoughts. Neither returned my messages. On your side, Brent Solomon, NBC 12.
Carry me back to old Virginia. There's where the cotton and the corn and taters grow. There's where the birds warble sweet in the springtime. There's where this old darkest Harlem long to go.
Jeb Stuart High School in Northern Virginia has been around for almost 60 years. It was named after a Confederate Army general who died in battle a year before the Civil War ended. And that's come up in the debate that's emerged about the best way to treat symbols of the Confederacy in public spaces. Tomorrow, the Fairfax County School Board will vote on changing the school's name. NPR's Bracton Booker has more.
A long line of buses rush students home as the school day ends in Falls Church, Virginia. Denise Patton is outside of Jeb Stuart High. She's a longtime resident here who says changing the name of the school is like trying to erase the past.
I'm dismayed that today people engage in presentism and still really thoroughly studying history.
James Ewell Brown Stuart was born in Virginia, and his military prowess is legendary. Patton says he was known for his mastery of reconnaissance and ability to keep Union soldiers at bay in battles not far from where the school is located.
And he kept them back for months. He was a tactician and a strategist.
Patton is known as a keeper, someone who wants the Jeb Stuart name to stay. She says the Civil War should be put in context, and those who approved the school's name when it opened in 1959 shouldn't be thought of as racist.
How we think about the Civil War today is not how people viewed the Civil War then. Some of these people had grandparents who fought in the Civil War. They weren't taught that these people were evil.
Oscar-winning actress Julianne Moore and movie producer Bruce Cohen, both Stuart alums, created an online petition. It's gotten nearly 40,000 signatures supporting the name change. Karen Keyes Gamara is on the Fairfax County School Board. She says the deadly white supremacist protests over the removal of a Confederate statue in Virginia this summer underscores why the name has got to go.
I think many of you was struck by what happened in Charlottesville. And so now I really do think that we need to make a clean break from the past.
She wants the school to be named after the first Black Supreme Court justice.
We need to replace this injustice to our community, I believe, with justice. And that is why I support the name Justice Thurgood Marshall, as I expect the school will be known as Justice High School.
Justice is one of a handful of new names the school board is considering. Another is simply Stewart, dropping the Jeb. Board member Karen Corbett Sanders hopes that option can provide a middle ground.
I fully believe we should take Jeb off the name of the school. I would like to see us consider combining names on the school, which has been done elsewhere in the country.
When the board votes tomorrow, it's a near certainty that Jeb Stuart High School's name will be no more. The estimated price tag to change everything from names on buildings to band uniforms, even the mascot, currently the Jeb Stuart Raiders, is nearly $1 million. Bracton Booker, NPR News.
College don't mean shit. Y'all niggas, and you gonna be niggas forever, just like us, niggas.
A Southfield woman in need of a locksmith shocked after getting a glimpse of a text conversation the worker had about her.
And Fox 2's Randy Wimbley live tonight in Southfield with more. He lets you see that message for yourself. Randy?
Hey guys, I saw that message, and while it may have been a joke, a bad one at that, that woman isn't laughing now, and she certainly was not laughing then. In fact, she was pretty shaken up and is very much so, so much so, in fact, that she wanted us to conceal her identity. As you mentioned, she was locked out of her condo, and she only got a glimpse of that locksmith's phone when he set it down, but his text messages were still up, and what she saw stunned her. Take a look.
It said F that N-I-G-G-E-R, and then dot, 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 just kidding. And then I felt so shocked.
What are you most concerned about now?
Right now, I am concerned for my safety. The fact that he is a locksmith, he can get into anything. I was afraid that he could have attacked me. If you feel that way about my race, you could have done anything to me, and I'm here alone. All he had to do was close the garage and done anything to me, and no one would have known. And again, the vehicle was not marked. It was his own personal vehicle.
And that's because that worker was contracted by the MNY Locksmith Company. I spoke with the owner. He says he does not tolerate that kind of language. The contractor is no longer working with him, and he also refunded that woman for the work that was done when the locksmith helped her get into her condo. She will be reaching out to police, she tells me, and even going so far as to get a PPO against that contractor, that locksmith, who came out to her home. Reporting live in Southfield, I'm Randy Wimbley, Fox 2 News.
This next story suggests how hard it can be to avoid racial discrimination. The story comes from a new survey of Americans of all races and ethnicities. It's being released this morning by NPR, the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, and the Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health. And it finds that a majority of people of all races, including white people, report that their group is discriminated against. This morning, we focus on one particular finding. Money may not shield people from bigotry. The survey included African Americans, and it found that more prosperous Black Americans, those making more than $75,000 a year, report more negative experiences than people who make less. NPR's Bracton Booker reports.
Philip Thompson is 55 years old and lives in an exclusive gated community with a golf course in one of the wealthiest exurbs of Washington, D.C.
How you doing?
I'm all right, bro. How you doing?
Come on in.
Once inside, he gives me a tour of his home. African art decorates the walls. Framed pictures of his kids hang in the entrance and...
Of course, American flag. My wife and I both military. This is my wife's what they call shadow box.
when you retire from the Air Force, they made her a nice shadow box with all her medals and ribbons and ranks.
Thompson is a retired lieutenant colonel in the Marine Corps, a Gulf War veteran, and a lawyer with his own practice. He's also the president of his local NAACP chapter. But when Thompson moved to this Leesburg, Virginia neighborhood 12 years ago, he says many of his mostly white neighbors made assumptions about how he could afford this house.
You couldn't have got here on your guile, on your knowledge, on being capable. I had to be a football player.
Well, he found that assumption deeply offensive.
So I just played to it and said, no, I'm a rapper or I'm a pimp. I'm a retired pimp. I'm gonna play to your stereotypes because then it makes you look even stupider.
Thompson's wife, Tanja, is a former senior master sergeant in the Air Force and now works as a mediator for the federal government. She says discrimination plays out in subtle ways.
Even living here in a gated community, there's definitely racism. And you see it walking down the street. You see people and you see them maybe in a professional setting, but when you see them out on the street, they turn the other direction. And then, too, they wonder, why are you here or how did you get here?
A new NPR poll finds a little more than half of all black respondents say they have been on the receiving end of negative comments. But that figure jumps to 73% for African Americans making $75,000 and up. Tanja has her theories about why.
When you make 75 or more, 100,000, you're dealing with more educated individuals and probably more so people who don't look like you.
Algernon Austin is the author of America is Not Post-Racial.
I think what sometimes people miss is what are the comparisons?
Austin, who is an economist, points out that, yes, college-educated and high-earning black folks are in many ways more likely to be better off than black people who earn less. But Austin, who did not work on NPR's poll, says there is overwhelming data showing that when comparing educated and high-earning blacks to their white counterparts,
the college-educated whites are going to have significantly more wealth, they're much less likely to be unemployed, they're moving further in terms of their careers. So in that comparison, African-Americans see, you know, that reinforces the sense of inequality in American society.
It's a sense shared by Philip Thompson.
I probably should be in a better position.
Thompson believes if he were a white man, he'd be wealthier and more successful. Bracton Booker, NPR News.
Billie Holiday, I sing your blues. Bet your life against me and I swear to God you'll lose it. Motherfuck the cops, we still singing for St. Louis. Motherfuck the cops, we still singing for St. Louis. Motherfuck the cops, we still singing for St. Louis.
The death this past week of award-winning actor Robert Guillaume reminded us that he was born in St. Louis and that he made a difference for African Americans in his profession, largely through his portrayal of the character Benson in two successful TV series. Joining me to discuss Guillaume's influence are Ron Himes, the founder and producing director of St. Louis Black Repertory Company. He joins us by phone. With me in studio is veteran actor J. Samuel Davis, who is well known to St. Louis audiences. Gentlemen, thanks so much for being with us.
You're welcome, sir. Pleasure to meet you.
I understand maybe we have lost Ron Himes. Hopefully we'll get him back during the course of our discussion. But I wanted to start with you, Jay, anyway, because yes. You knew Robert Guillaume.
I did. I was best friends with his youngest son, Jacques. And we met in grade school, and we continued to be friends all the way until his death in 1990. Growing up, we knew that Robert was into the arts. He was a stage man at that point before we graduated high school. So he was doing Jacques Brel at the Live and all that on Broadway. And so he was just a little name, but we were following him because we both were singers. His son had a phenomenal voice. I wish people could hear his voice. And I was highly influenced by him because he was a black man from St. Louis who was coming up through the ranks doing Broadway, which is what I wanted to do. And we graduated from high school, Jacques and I, Jacques went to join him. He had just got done doing Soap.
Which is what really launched the Benson
character.
Oh,
my goodness, yes. Yep. And so we were heartily following Soap. So when Jacques could, Robert sent for him, and he went to live with Robert. So that year, I went to stay with them while Jacques was living with him then. So I got to stay at Robert's house.
Well, that must have been quite an experience for a young man, because he was, at the time that you moved out there, he was an established figure on television.
He was. I used to call him a quiet giant because, of course, there were the Cosbys and, you know, all the other big personalities. But Robert was the lead of a major TV show long before it was, you know, popular for any African-American man to do so. And he did it on his own ranks. They gave him a spinoff because he was so good on soap. And so we went out there during the Benson years. Yeah.
Well, I've seen some interviews that he's done and, of course, read about him following his death. And one of the things that has struck me, and one of the reasons I wanted to talk with you and hopefully Ron a little bit later, is the fact that he was very, very careful about the way he played that role. He didn't want to be a stereotypical black buffoon, because it was a comedy role, and that's generally the way it worked out.
Yes, he had a lot to do with that, a lot of how he portrayed that role, because you know, of course, the writers were going in the direction of, you know, the sassy butler who you know, came in and did the one line quips, but he put a gravitas on it that they didn't expect, and he refused to be the brunt of the joke. You were the brunt of the joke, you know, via him. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what caught the attention, and they wanted to do that character further because he was not a stereotype butler. Mm-hmm. We had never seen a butler like that before.
Sure.
And went on to take that to greater heights as Benson.
What sort of an influence do you think that he in that role had on people who are coming up behind him?
Well,
such as
I can speak for myself. Yeah. Like I said, quiet giant, lead of a major TV show in an era when that was not done. Highly influential, a vocalist, a director, a great actor. He had done other things on TV as well as short stories on TV as well. So he was highly influential. I wanted to be just like him. Mm-hmm. And so did his son, Jacques. Mm-hmm. We would sit at his feet sometimes, and he would, you know, tell us about the business and sort of where to go and what not to do and stuff like that. But, you know, he was a disciplinarian, so he didn't really push Jacques to do stuff, but he was there to help Jacques, but not, you know, push him to do anything, you know.
I understand that Ron Himes has joined us now from
Black Rep.
Ron, nice to have you with us.
Hi, how you doing, Don? Hey, Jay.
Hey.
We're doing just great. Let me put the questions to you that we've been talking with Jay about. How was Robert Guillaume an inspiration to you, perhaps, and to other people in the theater profession?
Well, you know, as a young company, when we were, you know, in our infancy in the theater and during the 23rd Street days, you know, was Guillaume had played Pearlie in, you know, the Broadway production of Pearlie. And then, you know, we knew him from his television work, from Soap, and then the spinoff to the show Benson. And in Benson, you know, he was the man. He ran everything. And so it was always, you know, a great role model in terms of the kind of role that he played, the dignity that his characters had, and then just sort of his background, you know, of course, being from, knowing that he was from St. Louis, and that, you know, he had grew up really, really poor in St. Louis, but, you know, managed to pull himself up. I then began following him, knowing that he had spent time at the Caramu House as an actor there. And then, you know, he moved to New York and his, you know, career just sort of took off. Always wanted to try to get him to come back to St. Louis to do something with the Rep. We weren't able to do that. But just following him was always just so inspirational and a bar for us to, you know, try to reach.
Jay and I have talked about this part of it. I'd like to get your take on it, Ron. And that is that he was very purposeful in the way he accepted the role of Benson. He was a little leery of it initially because he thought it could be a kind of a play to a black stereotype, which he didn't want to do. He didn't want to be a buffoon or servile. And that was very important to him, and I think also to African-Americans in the profession.
Oh, yeah, for sure. That's when I mentioned, you know, his dignity, his character. You know, he ultimately wound up being the man with the authority, and he knew how to wield that authority and how to use it. He knew how to conduct himself, you know, to get the things done that he needed to get done. And he was able to sort of deal with all of the challenges that came to the office in that role that allowed him to do it with, you know, such dignity and grace.
He had a lot of influence in that writing and in that portrayal. You know, he would talk with the writers and stuff and, you know, get them to do, you know, take the storylines further. You know what I mean? And so.
Do you have any sense, either one of you, with regard to how that was accepted amongst the writers and the producers and the directors?
I think
well,
that,
you know,
go ahead, Ron.
Go ahead, Dre. No, go ahead.
I think that that in order for the show to continue and him to still portray Benson, and they had to, you know, give him a listen, and you can't argue with the success of the show. I mean, the writings, the things that he influenced and stuff for the character certainly sent that show into another level. You know what I'm saying? They had to have this sort of input into what was going on with his character and the storyline.
Even early on, I mean, they didn't know what they were getting.
They really didn't. Yeah. And he fashioned that show. He was very influential in how that show turned out.
Ron?
Right. I think, you know, again, that it was, you know, it was one of those Norman Lear shows. And at the time, you know, Norman Lear was really pushing the envelope. And so he was working with actors, all kinds of actors, but particularly he was working with black actors who were willing to, you know, take that risk with him and really push the political agenda and push, you know, the kinds of putting the kinds of characters and the kinds of situations on the screen that people hadn't done before. You know, just that whole sort of series of shows that Norman Lear, you know, sort of fostered was consistent with the kind of work that Guillaume was able to do on Benson.
Everyone knows Fats Domino's house here in the lower Ninth Ward. It's modest for a man with 21 gold records. But at the height of Katrina, no one here could find their local legend. And newspapers around the country said the American music icon was feared dead. He more than proved to us today he is very much alive.
Fats Domino took the rhythms of New Orleans and used them to help build the foundation of rock and roll. Elvis Presley tipped his hat to Domino, as did hundreds of others who followed in his footsteps. Fats Domino died in his sleep yesterday of natural causes. He was 89 years old. Gwen Tompkins has our appreciation.
In the 1940s, Antoine Domino Jr. was working at a mattress factory in New Orleans and playing piano at night. Both his waistline and his fan base were expanding. That's when a band leader began calling him Fats. From there, it was a cakewalk to his first million-selling record. Was Domino's first release for Imperial Records, which signed him right off the bandstand. Dave Bartholomew was there. He described the scene in a 1981 interview now housed at the Hogan Jazz Archive at Tulane University.
Fats was rocking and jiving, and he was sweating and playing. He put his whole heart and soul in what he was doing, and people was crazy about him, so that was it. And we made our first record, The Fat Man, and we never turned around.
Between 1950 and 1963, Fats Domino hit the R&B charts a reported 59 times and the pop charts a rollicking 63 times.
I'm gonna be a wheel someday. I'm gonna be somebody. I'm gonna be a real gone cat. Then I won't want you.
He outsold Little Richard, Chuck Berry, and Buddy Holly combined. Only Elvis Presley moved more records during that stretch, but Presley cited Domino as the early master.
When Whippoorwill call, and even if night, I hurry to my blue heaven.
So how does a black man with a fourth grade education in the Jim Crow South, the child of Haitian Creole plantation workers, and the grandson of a slave, sell more than 65 million records? Domino could wah, wah, wah and woo-hoo like nobody else in the whole wide world. And he made piano triplets ubiquitous in rock and roll. John Cleary is a piano player who's devoted most of his life to the New Orleans sound.
The triplets thing, this little pan. That was one of the building blocks of New Orleans R&B. And that's really the famous Fats Domino groove, you know. I found my thrill. Everybody knows that.
On Blueberry Hill. On Blueberry Hill. When I found you.
And then there was producer and arranger Dave Bartholomew. He and engineer Cosimo Matassa perfected a rhythm-heavy sound in Matassa's studio that was the envy of rock and roll. Blueberry Hill may have been Domino's biggest hit, but Bartholomew wrote Domino's favorite.
Blue Monday, how I hate Blue Monday. Got to work like a slave all day. Here come Tuesday, oh, Tuesday. I'm so tired, got no time to play.
Blue Monday had other levels of meaning in Domino's career. In the 1950s, the birth of rock and roll was hard labor. Social critics called the music vulgar. Jim Crow laws segregated Domino's audiences, sometimes with only a rope. And the combination of racial tension and teenage hormones at concerts proved violent. Bottle throwing, tear gas, stabbings, arrests. Here's Domino biographer Rick Coleman.
It was not an easy time period, even though the music was beautiful and joyful. It was a hard birth.
By 1960, Domino's audience was overwhelmingly white. And boy, what a wide spectrum of white people they were. In South Carolina, the Ku Klux Klan gave the band directions by the light of a burning cross. Saxophone player Herbert Hardesty was driving the Domino bus.
So I had to make a turn. In about 5 minutes, I came to the Ku Klux Klan. They said, well, where's Fats Domino? I said, he's not here. He said, well, what are you guys doing? I said, I'm lost. I'm trying to get back to the highway. And they were very nice. The Ku Klux Klan treated us very nice.
The British invasion sent nearly every American performer tumbling down the charts. And yet longtime confidant Idae Ellis says Domino wouldn't change a note.
He said, when I play, I want the people to hear exactly what they're used to hearing on the record. And eventually, that was one of the things that made him reluctant to play, let's say, was he was afraid that he would mess up a word or a whatever.
Domino toured for many years, but eventually settled into life at his compound in the Lower Ninth Ward, cooking loads of hogshead cheese for his many friends. Then came Hurricane Katrina, and everybody thought Fats was dead.
When Katrina came, odd. Fats would say he wanted to leave, but he said, what kind of man would I be if I left my family? They don't want to leave.
The family survived. Fats Domino lived out the post-Katrina years in a suburb of New Orleans with one of his eight children. But his house still stands on Caffin Street in the Lower Ninth Ward. The initials FD are on the front facade. They're a reminder of the greatness the neighborhood once produced, of the golden age of New Orleans music, and of the fat man who rocked the world. For NPR News, I'm Gwen Tompkins in New Orleans.
This time I'm walking to New Orleans. I'm walking to New Orleans. I'm gonna need to pay.
Context of white supremacy. Gusty Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Saturday, October 28th, 2017. So I have been told this is our weekly compensatory call-in Dial in if you have observations, counter-racist suggestions, thoughts on any of the news clips that we just heard, or any of the other news items that happened over the past 7 days. The number 641-715-3640. The code 564-943-pound. Press star 6 if you would like to participate. Number one more time, 641-715-3640. Code 564-943-pound. Press star 61 if you would like to participate. Star 61 if you want to join the conversation. A couple things before we get started. First, we are listener-supported counter-racist radio. Invest if you think the program is constructive. Racism-notes.blogspot.com. Racism-notes.blogspot.com. When you hit the blog, PayPal button is in the top right corner. If you're not into PayPal, drop us an email and we will get you a physical mailing address. Huge thanks to all the folks who have supported, invested. 9-year anniversary coming up in February. Hope we have given out some constructive information to help non-white listeners, victims of white supremacy, get a more accurate understanding of what racism is and how it works. You can also support by visiting our Amazon wish list, which is also linked on the blog. It's on Amazon under Gus T. Renegade. Huge thanks to all the generous folks, generous listeners who have picked up items from the list. Hugely appreciated. Some of the upcoming programs. First up, Pam should be coming back with us next month in November. As I said, she was supposed to be with us this past week. She was not feeling well, unfortunately. We have been wishing her the best, praying for her speedy recovery. And I've been sending her well wishes from you all as well. A lot of folks commented on social media when I let people know that she was not feeling well. But she should be back with us next month. It would be good to check in with her. We're supposed to have John Patash on the program tomorrow. He wrote the book, The FBI's War on Tupac Shakur and Black Leaders. He's been on the program a few times. He also wrote the book, Drugs as a Weapon Against Us. He was on the program last year to discuss that. We were going to talk about his work in the context of the Black Identity Extremists report that came out from the FBI just a few weeks back. But we rescheduled as opposed to tomorrow. It will be a week from tomorrow, which is Sunday, November 5th. He'll be with us normal time, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. Before we get to that, Robin Maynard, she should be with us this coming Tuesday, which I think is so-called holiday. But she should be joining us live from Canada, no less, to talk about her new book, which talks about policing Black bodies in Canada. And how racism, whites, I think they call it carding up there, where they want to stop you and see your papers. Plantation days, yes. But she should be here this coming Tuesday. You know, we have listeners up in the north of the U.S. border. So if you all want to make sure you have your questions prepped, our Canadian listeners, this Tuesday, 8 p.m. Eastern. Looking forward to it. A couple other things that I wanted to make sure I shared before we get to the callers. Number one, and really this was, you know, I don't really care about much of anything else that happens on the program. I want to make sure that we address this first and foremost. We have a teenage Black female listener. She has written in to share, you know, just her thoughts, what she observes in her school setting for a while. I've read some of her comments on the program before. I think I've even read some for workplace racism because I, you know, I've said school is like work for children. It is work for children. Anyway, she wrote me just a couple days ago. This is her situation. So I'm reading. This is she is a high school senior, 17 years old, Black female. She writes, I have a dilemma. I'm currently in my senior year of high school, and I have to take a government class. My teacher is a Pakistani male, and ever since classes have started, he's been acting inappropriately towards me. I'm going to list the incidents, and she gives a bullet list like a professional. I spoke during a debate, and I mostly talked about education reform. He said some negative things about black people during this debate. Next. The day after this debate, he looked through my files, came to my gym class, and claimed he needed to talk about my grades. He leaned close to me, told me how smart I was, and that he looked through my grades and asked me for suggestions on how to run the class. This made me uncomfortable because I couldn't figure out why he took me out of my gym class. I said yes to all of his questions so that he would leave me alone. Next. When he and one of my friends were outside of the classroom, he asked her why I didn't like him. And she put "like" in quotes, professional counter-racist. When she said she didn't know, he claimed she wasn't telling the truth and that she was just trying to get out of the conversation. Next, I handed a paper to him, the teacher, for a friend of mine because he made her leave the class. I gave it to him, and the following day, I asked if he completed it. When he said no, I simply told him it was a time-sensitive thing. He responded by calling me irresponsible and saying that I was rushing him. He proceeded to tell my same friend that I was rushing him. Next up, when students confront him, he usually says that he is... Oh, wait a minute, sorry. During our class debates, he harasses black male students and makes racist comments. He also referred to women as sluts. When students confront him, he usually says that he is 12% black and therefore his behavior is appropriate. I resorted to doing my homework in class so that I wouldn't be tempted to engage with him. Next, today he gave me a 0 for the class day because I was doing my homework. Meanwhile, students were on their phones, and despite his strict no cell phone policy, he said nothing to them. He expected me to respond, but I said nothing. After class, he was wandering around the room and talking to students. Since he usually leaves the classroom first, I believe he did this, hoping I would approach him about my grade. End of the bullet list. Overall, he has made it his job to make me feel uncomfortable. In the past, he was accused of sexual assault / being sexually involved with a student. He was not in the school for a long time, but he eventually came back because nothing was proven or something along those lines. I really do not feel like coming to class, but I cannot have any low grades at this time. As of now, I am simply ignoring him. I would greatly appreciate some advice. Okay, the first war, again, if folks need reminders on why I think it would be phenomenal practice of counter-racism before you hit the bedroom, you have thorough conversation, comprehensive, detailed conversation about the first 10, 15 years of your child's educational program. What it's going to look like, you know, are you going to homeschool, what options, you know, all of that stuff for the first, as I said, 10, 15 years of your child's life, so that as best you can, this can be mitigated, minimized. Now, what I recommended, or at least some of the things that I would recommend, and what I wrote to her, and I told her that we would address this on the program, so she might even be listening, with regards to the comments about the black students, right? She was saying he was making racist comments. I would detail exactly what he said. And I would tell any of the other black students, if you have friends that are in the class, I would write down exactly what he says, verbatim. Don't add anything. Don't mess it up. Be perfect. Write it down to the exact letter and then just chart date, time. This is what he said. Date, time. This is what he said. Boom, boom, boom. And if you get a class of students, it's not just one person. It's 3, 4, 5 of them that have notes, dates, times. He said this, he said this, he said this. So it's not one person saying this, and they have records. And I mean, woo, now all of the technology that young people have, I am sure somebody has got, you know, 2 or 3 of the new iPhone 10s, or at least got the pre-order. If recording is allowed, I know they have different rules or what have you. And matter of fact, let me make sure I preface. The first thing I said was to make sure that you speak with your parents. I've said before, Gus T doesn't have children. I certainly said, make sure you speak with your parents. And I said explicitly, I would talk with your parents about this incident and with the comments specifically. Write them down and or speak with your parents if you have a phone about recording these comments, depending on what your school policy is and if you feel comfortable. But that has been done as well, where some students did the same thing we talk about on workplace racism. Either their white classmates and or faculty members were making racist comments, and they just whip the phone out and record, and boop, you pretty much get the same result as what happens in the workplace. So you can talk with your parents and see if that's a viable option with regards to the comments, which is serious. What I think is much more serious, anything where you are feeling uncomfortable, he's coming to talk to you in a different class. He's coming to your gym class to talk to you and questions that to you, it doesn't even seem logical why he would be coming to your gym class to ask you, the student, about how he should run his government class. I mean, what things like that I would take very seriously. You said, you know, this instructor, Pakistani instructor, that apparently he was accused or suspected of some sort of sexual misconduct with a student. Anything like that, I would take extremely seriously. If you don't feel comfortable, I would be looking to get out of this class. And I have seen before, I've worked in school systems on both coasts, and I've seen where particularly once there's some sort of allegation about I don't feel comfortable, anything sexual, I have seen, hey, we are not trying to have any lawsuits or anything like that, where they can go to great lengths for that student, even if that means even if we can't put you in another class, you can get a study hall for this period where you go to the library or you go someplace else. Where you have, you know, an instructor, or maybe even you can go someplace by yourself and just sit and study and you do the work and, you know, you don't have to have contact. I have seen where they can do that sort of thing, where they can get very creative with regards to solving a problem where a student does not feel comfortable and there's any sort of suspicion about sexual misconduct. She didn't say anything like that. But if you're not feeling that he is conducting himself in a professional and appropriate manner in how he deals with you, in addition to the racist comments and the way that he's treating the black students in your class, I would talk with your parents seriously about getting out of this class. And especially if it's something where you feel like he might be being punitive with your grades and what have you in your senior year, that's really serious. I don't know what your plans are after all this, if you're looking, you know, going to college and what have you, but certainly they look at that. If they see a dip in your grades where it looks like, you know, you were doing really well and then you started having problems, that can, you know, cause concern. So I would take it very seriously, as it sounds like you are. And I would speak with your parents and go to the school to raise these concerns. Do it exactly as you outlined here with a bullet list. And I would be saying, hey, I think it would be best for my senior year for me to really be able to focus on my academics and not have any distractions. I would like to get a different government instructor. And if that's not possible, I need to not be in his class. And I would even maybe say as a last option, that's something that I would encourage also, try to think of solutions that are acceptable to you. If you have a problem at school or really any environment, try to think of, you know, 3-4 solutions that would be acceptable to you with regards to solving the problem, and see if you can get at least one of those to be accepted and acted on. But if all else, they should have another instructor. If it's a teacher's aide, somebody else who is present for all of his classes to monitor, or at least until you feel comfortable that this is not going to be a problem. But I mean, that would be really last resort, to have someone who's acceptable come in, observe that way. And that way, everything should be covered. If he's conducting himself inappropriately with students, that'll be monitored. And if he's making racist comments in front of the class or degrading black people, all of that will be monitored. That would kind of be my last resort in terms of a solution for the problem. But I would really be focused on getting out of this class as soon as possible. Again, I do not have children. If we have black parents, this is certainly a time that I would request that you not spectate and go ahead and dial in 641-715-3000. 3640 if you have any suggestions, because that's what she asked for, suggestions on how to deal with this situation. And again, I hope that you spoke with your parents and addressed all of these concerns, and, you know, they could talk it out and give you, you know, their thoughts on how they want to proceed with this. But if we have any Black parents who are listening in, if you have any thoughts, suggestions, what you would recommend on dealing with this, or if you have any experience having had to deal with this in terms of a child not feeling comfortable in a class and you had to go and rectify that situation, man, that would be super appreciated to dial in and hear that. Also wanted to get in quickly in the, or I guess it's similar with the school situation with regards to education, that situation in Virginia, where the young racist children were pretending to rape the Black out of these young Black students, middle school Black students, again, between the ages of like 11 and 13. They have a more recent report from within like the last 48 hours. They had a big town hall meeting in Virginia, and lots of, it looked like predominantly Black parents to me. The videos on my Facebook page looked like predominantly Black parents to me. There were a number of white parents present as well. One of the concerns that was raised in the meeting was that some of the parents alleged that the school officials did not share all of the information about this video in a prompt manner and may have even edited out, like they didn't want to show how bad all of this was, what, you know, these little white urchins were doing at the school, and felt that they, you know, were not given all of the information about this situation in a prompt and accurate manner. And I said, pattern. I think we've heard that before, even recently, where along the same lines, I think it was within the last 2 weeks, a white school official was sending racist emails and other white faculty members found out about this, and they didn't share all this information with all of the other school officials who should have known so that they could have made an appropriate and professional decision with all the information. They shielded it. And I think in that situation, it was specifically they shielded it from other Black school faculty members who would have been in position to, you know, make a judgment on whether this person, you know, should have retained their employment. Pattern. Withholding information happens all the time. And again, in my view, you can't be ignorant. You cannot be ignorant about white supremacy, racism, what it means to be white, and continue to see that pattern where Black people or incidents of racism, white supremacy consistently are sanitized. Consistently, there's some effort to withhold that information going out to the public promptly, accurately. Next, there was really important, I'll put it that way, really important reports in the LA Times this week. They were focusing specifically on the just horrendous attack on Black children, Black mothers. They were focused specifically on the high maternal mortality rate for Black mothers specifically. And this is another one where I'd emphasize they didn't say Blacks and Latinos. They didn't say Black and brown people. They didn't see Black people or Black mothers and women of color mothers. They said Black mothers exclusively, and the maternal mortality rate. And what, in my opinion, at least, what I thought made these both of these reports, and I posted them both on my Facebook page, the one report, Black doulas, midwives, and reproductive health advocates step up in response to rising Black maternal deaths. That's one. And then the other report, the quiet crisis among African Americans. You can check out both of these reports from the LA Times. They were published within, as I said, like the last 48 hours. I think Thursday, both of the reports came out, published by a Black female journalist, Ann Simmons, Importance of Black Journalism. But also, in addition to the fact that prominent, critical, vital information, something that needs to be addressed. This would be a public emergency if it was white women were in this sort of crisis with maternal mortality rates. But getting this information out so that people can be more aware. And this is another way that racism, white supremacy is practiced. And these reports had a lot of great resources. We have folks who have inquired about lactation counselors, doulas, midwives. I did that program at the beginning of the year about baby showers and racism, saying that I was spending so much time around a pregnant Black mother, and she was voicing her concerns about having difficulties finding resources, being a first-time Black mother at the time. She was a pregnant Black mom and having difficulties finding resources for Black moms specifically, especially here in Washington State. But these reports have a lot of great resources in different areas, Texas, California, and they have links where you can go to their websites. So if you're close to these regions or even just want to check their website, give them a call. If you're looking for information, resources, maybe even resources in your area, even if you can maybe contact some of the folks in Texas, even if you live in Louisiana, they might know something. So check out both of those reports. I might even link them again, but they are on my Facebook page. Ann Simmons, great work at the LA Times. Last thing. Oh, that was everything. With that, we will get to the callers again for this broadcast exclusively. If we could refrain from using metaphors. Thank you kindly. The Texans owner, Mr. McNair, great illustration of metaphors. This week, we've been talking about those a lot with Crazy Talk, Stupid Talk, our book for the book club. But it's been my experience that racists, they often use metaphors to practice racism, white supremacy, as was the case with Mr. McNair. He used a metaphor and perhaps revealed a little bit too much truth about what he really thinks about his prisoners, I mean players. But for this broadcast, no metaphors. I think Mr. McNair wishes he had taken that code, that rule, no metaphors. But no metaphors, if we could be explicit, precise about what it is that we want to say. That would be super appreciated. I will prompt about that. Thank you kindly for those observing that. If we could take about 5 minutes to share whatever thoughts that you have, that would be great. That way everybody gets at least one chance to share. We should have ample time. So once everybody gets an opportunity to speak once, and then if you have other questions or comments you want to get in, just make sure you wait until everybody's spoken once. If you know you're in a loud environment, if you could use your mute button, that would be super appreciated. Just helps preserve the audio quality of the broadcast and people don't have to be talking over unnecessary noise. With that, first few folks who dialed in with a hand up, line should be open. Proceed.
That was really good advice you gave to the young lady. Especially, well, one, talking to her parents, and also especially with, I guess, contacting her in the gym environment, that seems highly inappropriate. I don't know, no one wants to go to the gym, barely the gym teachers, so that seems weird to me. And if possible, I will contact, because that seems very, I don't know, public authorities or something, because that just seems weird to me. Good clips, especially the first clips about food, because it was weird. I was thinking I was going to call in tonight to ask people this, because I thought it'd be very off topic, but maybe it's not. I noticed here, I live in the South, and that the collard greens, for some reason, they seem pretty high, like $2.99 a bunch or something. I don't know how many people in the South shop for collard greens, whatever. But like in New York, it's not. My mother tells me it doesn't cost that much. And I just think that's weird. The food that Black people tend to eat a lot is high. I don't know why. Like, I don't know anything about the production. I was thinking I had to look into that because I just don't understand personally why that particular product is high, knowing that a great deal of Black people eat that product and it's high down here in the South where you would think it was grown. So that, I thought that was weird. But I definitely agree with the about eating the weird foods. And then the medicine, not the medicine clip, the NIH clip with them using the church. We know that that's a strategy they've used in the past for years and years. And I know it's VGQ that, you know, you can invite whoever you want to speak to your people. But I don't know, I just thought I would save that for a Wednesday meeting or something, not the Sunday service. Thank you.
Indeed. Other folks with a hand up, and again, remind Black parents, please do not be a spectator this time around. If you have any suggestions or advice for the black female teenager, that would be appreciated. Other folks with a hand up, proceed.
Yes, can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Greetings, Gus, to the callers and the listeners. As far as the young lady is concerned, I think that she is on the right track because she is looking at the world through the correct lenses. I don't know if that's a metaphor or not, but she's very, it seems like she knows what's going on. So me personally, with my experience as a parent, I totally eliminated my children from the public school system. And even though she's a senior and she's about to graduate from high school or whatever, it's not too late to homeschool. She can even really actually begin taking more college courses early, like as of now. Hold on, let me close my garage door. But that will be an option to remove herself from that situation. Maybe homeschooling is an option, but that's just my contribution to that. But as far as I know, this subject is redundant to you, but as far as metaphors are concerned, I think the term white supremacy is a metaphor. I mean, I know the context of white supremacy is your brand, but maybe context of white suppression or something, but by calling them supreme is giving them power. Just every time we say it gives them power in our mind and in the universe. They're not superior, so they cannot be white supremacists. They are not supreme. And I know that that topic is touchy with you, but I just can't get over it. We have to come up with something else. They're not supreme. And I'll mute my line, man. Thanks for taking my call.
For sure. Other folks who dialed in with a hand up, if we've not heard you, if you have commentary, proceed.
May I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Good evening, Gus. Good evening to the callers and to the listeners. This is the black female from New York. With regard to our young scholar who is having these difficulties, I'm extremely sorry and really kind of upset that she has to go through this. However, I would say that I admire her methodology in recording all of these acts. I think she has done an excellent job in documenting this pedophile. I'm going to call him a racist pedophile because, in my opinion, he is acting like a white person. So this racist pedophile who is exhibiting his pathologies in an educational environment can be neutralized with that list that she has made. I would suggest that she take that list to the administrators in her school with the help of her parents, because a precedent has already been set with this racist pedophile in that he already has a history of this type of behavior that has been documented. So she should discuss with her parents what has occurred, show them her list. And if she feels very, very uncomfortable to the point where she feels that she wants to not be in that institution, that is a good idea, as the previous caller had suggested, as well as the remedies you suggested, Gus, with having her do some sort of independent study. But it should definitely go to be placed in front of the administrators for them to deal with this racist pedophile. With regard to the first clip about DNA and whites using a black person, Reverend Calvin Butts, to recruit black people to be DNA donors. I would just like to again say that Columbia University, the land-grabbing dominators who own most of Harlem, are just another tool being used to record and set black people up. I think that a few weeks ago, Gus, there was another clip that you played on the compensatory call-in where a young man was arrested and spent time in jail because they said that he had committed some crime. And the reason was because they had got his DNA off of a Dunkin' Donuts touchscreen. And the main point that was brought out in this report was that this DNA evidence used by law enforcement is not regulated. So I think that this is another strategy that whites are using to record our DNA. And then again, they are using all of these things and all of these scientific things. You know, they're making skin creams and, you know, suntan lotions and all kinds of things with our DNA. And it just further shows how black people in the clergy are being used by politicians and these entities to get their agendas across. There was another clip that you played regarding the situation in, I want to say Niger, but it's Niger, right? These days. And there was something mentioned about water contamination. Many years ago, an elder told me that any new struggles that we have are not going to be based on money. They're not going to be based on oil. They're going to be based on our most, the resource that we need to live the most, and that's water. And we could see what's happening, what had happened in Flint, Michigan. And from what I understand, that water is, they're still having that situation. And I just bring that up because I get my water from a local spring here in South Carolina. And the spring is something that is a historical spring, and it's supposed to be deeded to God by the person who owned the land many, many years ago. And it's something that everybody comes to, so, like, from all over the country. And even like some, I met a woman there from Poland there a few weeks ago. You know, they come in to get this water. And the county takes care of the land, so you know it's truly not free. I mean, it's not something that's, you know, not owned by anybody. But anyway, there's a push now to get this water regulated, and pretty soon it's not going to be something that we can go get. They're going to use pipelines, and they're going to use that in order to treat it. And it doesn't need to be treated because it's coming straight out of the ground from a fault inside of the ground, and commercialize it. And that's something that's kind of going on all over the country. You know, the battle is with water, regulating any kind of natural water or contaminating the water so that you'll have to buy it. And these water companies and these people that can bottle these waters can make a lot of money. So I just wanted to share that as well. And I think that was it. As far as this, the educators in these schools are concerned, if any parent is out there, has a young child, I do suggest that you homeschool. That's all I had. And I'll mute my line. Thanks for listening.
Appreciate that. Other folks who dialed in, if you have a hand up. Yes, sir. Thomas in New York.
Peace, Gus. Peace to all the callers. I just wanted to say a few things. The young girl, I would hope that she would go speak to a lawyer as soon as possible, just to let them hear what she has to say. and see what their suggestions would be, if there's any legal grounds, even the threat of a lawsuit to a school would make drastic changes. Because if you're saying that you're in a bad situation with someone at a school or with an employer, and something happens and they knew about it, they're in big trouble. So I would even go ahead above administration and go to get a lawyer, just a consultation, speak to someone and see what they say. And I would even say it doesn't even matter if the lawyer is white or black. I would even go get a white lawyer in this instance. Just to really hammer it home. And you won't have to pay anything, trust me. Columbia University, $10 billion endowment fund. They own most of the Morningside area, Far West Harlem, everything but the projects over there, and they're trying to get those. Their hospital in Washington Heights has 33 buildings. Think of that. Why don't they just pay people for their DNA? They got a number of black people all around. I mean, just pay them. Everyone needs money. But working with Abyssinian Baptist Church doesn't surprise me. Sunday in Harlem, the line gets wrapped around from the church entrance, which is in the middle of 138th Street, between 7th and Lenox, or politically correct, between Adam Clayton Powell and Malcolm X. It goes up to 7th Avenue, wraps around to 139th Street, down 139th Street to Lenox, back over to 138th Street, and back to the middle of the church. All white people. No black people in this line. All over the world, they come to go to get black spirituality in the form of Christianity, unfortunately. So these black people who go to this church are very angry because they don't even get a seat in their own church. They have to get there 2 hours early and just to get a seat, and they also have to help prepare for the white people to come. And the people who live in that area are very angry because on Sunday morning they can't walk out their own apartment because they're right there or all in front of their building standing waiting to get into this church. So church is a business, and Abyssinia gets a lot of money, kickbacks from the city of New York. Their church is a tourist destination, and there's a bunch of them in New York City. And they also are probably getting paid by Columbia University and not giving their patrons any of this money. Africa, a total disaster. France, once again, they're weak on war. They can't fight. They can't hold any territory. They couldn't hold Haiti 200 years ago. Couldn't hold Vietnam 60 years ago, and they can't hold their African territories now. So they have to call in for the more stronger fighting white people like the United States to go do their bidding for them, which is just a recourse of French history. Africa is going to be where the next war is for, I think. Someone sent, one of the listeners to the show sent me a few clips on it. And, you know, Africa has, China has a stronghold there. Like they said, China is building infrastructure in exchange for resources, and white people for Christianity in exchange for resources. So, you know, we get a bridge, a tunnel, or we get a church. So they're cutting the deals with Chinese people, and Europe can't survive without Africa. Their food comes from Africa. Everything they have comes from Africa. They have nothing in Europe. They don't even have trees that much. Like, it's just, they have nothing. So I could see the next war between these Europeans and, of course, the United States and, you know, China. It'll be fought in Africa, unfortunately, a huge part of it. Miami Gardens, I thought about the firefighter. The congressional black caucus leader, the black lady with the cowboy hat. I don't know her name, but now she's been getting life threats. The Secret Service have to protect her. She's afraid to go to Washington, D.C., and she wouldn't give out the gist of the attacks, but she said they were racist. So, back to France, this is the last thing. And just a way to for people to get a better perspective, of change their perspective so that that way they can get a better perception of history. Just think of this, and I'm going to leave it at this. The French Quarter. The French Quarter is in Louisiana, down in New Orleans. And we heard about the brother Fats who passed away. Rest in peace to him. One of the black creators of rock and roll that he did. You know, I'm glad he did. They only get their credit when they're dead. But in 1719, they create the French Quarters. France, the country, isn't established until 1792. So the question is when you look at this, is who are the French in the French Quarters? And why are these French-speaking people in Louisiana? Now, mute my line, Gus.
Yes, sir. Was it Congresswoman Frederica Wilson? Is that who you were talking about who's getting the death threats? She's the...
That's her.
Okay.
That's her.
Right on. Other folks who dialed in with a hand up, if you had commentary you wanted to share, lines should be open. Feel free.
May I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. Hello to just the host and to all the listeners and other callers. Hopefully, you know, all is going well with you on the plantation. Just a couple of things. I think the advice that you gave to the students is very good advice. And I just would probably say, too, that, like you said, talk to some of your other classmates because, you know, things that he's saying out in the classroom, you know, I know others have to be hearing that. And then, like you said, telling them to take notes, dates and times and stuff like that, and then take it to, you know, parents. And, you know, then they
didn't even realize that.
Hello?
Yes, ma'am. Sorry about that. I was trying to get the noise out of the line.
Oh, okay. And so because it was just we know that was just improper of him taking her out of her gym class. Asking her how could he teach a class or whatever it was he did. But we know that was improper. So I think your advice was very good. As far as the first clip, I think, about the church, and as I laid here listening to it, and I just shook my head, said, it's so sad. Because then when they talk to the people, and, you know, you got people, and just because the minister is saying this, you know, you got people running, sure, I want to be a part of this. I want to be a part of this. And all I can say is thank goodness for those who just like, uh-uh. I used to work at Tuskegee University. And so, you know, that's a part of, even though it was the government study in Tuskegee, Alabama, but, you know, working at Tuskegee. And, you know, we talk about it. And I've worked with a young lady whose grandparents, maternal and paternal grandparents, were a part of that study. And, you know, she talked about how it affected, you know, their family. And so to see how they use the church, and I was listening to that, I said, he must be getting something from the government because we know this stuff works hand in hand. They, you know, and then just listen to what Thomas was saying about, you know, how, you know, now that church, it's a tourist site and, you know, the black people that's really supporting the church, you know, are basically being kicked to the curb to deal, you know, to take care of the white tourists as, you know, black people, as we are good at doing, taking care of white people. And the situation in Africa is just, it is, oh my gosh, it is just so sad. And, all you know, I'm just like, we're going to have to learn how to fight that. I thought the gentleman that made the comparison, he said, what's going on here in this country with black people? And basically, you know, they're coming over there, it becomes the same thing. And I remember the story about I think it was the movie with Tom Hanks about, you know, the ship off on the coast of Somalia and how the movie presented it. Oh, my God. And somebody I was listening to one time, and they said, no, said they were over there, something about doing something to the water, and basically the Somalians were basically fighting back. So it's just really fighting. And it's really something to hear how France is doing all this. And as Thomas says, so weak. But yet they're everywhere. They, you know, they still got Haiti. They still making Haiti pay astronomical sums of money to them for things that have, you know, for the war, you know, when Haiti defeated them. And then you're running around this world trying to control everything, and yet you don't even have the strength to be able to do what you do. And we know this country, especially with black people, would be more than happy to go in. But they didn't expect to. Yeah, I'm quite sure there are I won't call them Nigerians, but the people from Niger that are dying. But I'm quite sure they were shocked when those four that we know of were killed. And I guess, you know, the thing is, because, you know, we can't fight back. So it's just, you know, it's just like you can see it, and it just doesn't look good. And I'm just hoping that it may not be as bad as I'm thinking that it will be. The part about the, I think, which was also a part of the story with the church, and I do like the way this lady said, and let's not play games with this. Let's call it what it is, genetic engineering. Because that's really what it is. Also, like, too, when the guy said he wouldn't give up his stuff because, you know, like, the DNA, and he's like, I don't know what they'll do with that DNA. And I can agree with that because they're taking blood from you, and, you know, there's a lot of information that I can get about you just, you know, looking at your blood and stuff. And we know this country has a wealth of history coming to us, you know, oh, we can do this, we'll help you do this, and yet, you know, get what it is that they want from us and then take it and use it against us. We have a wealth of history for that. And so respect, much respect to Fats Domino and to Robert Guillaume and their passing this week. It is something to hear about, like you said, how Fats Domino, and I think that only Elvis was putting out, it gets more music or more records, and we know Elvis was what, he was a thief when it comes to music. And it was good to hear, though, how Robert Guillaume had decided how he was going to play this role in Benson and not fall for the typical stereotypes that Hollywood would be giving him. And I think that speaks volumes to the character of a person. Even probably, I would like to believe to the point that had things gotten crazy, that he could have made up his mind that he would walk away as opposed to going down that road. And I think that's about it. That's it, dude. So I'll mute myself. Thank you for taking my call.
Yes, ma'am. Caller in Ohio. If other folks had commentary they wanted to share, number to dial 641-715-3640. The code 564-943-pound. Press star 61 if you would like to participate. I was reminded, since I mentioned the book club once, I'm so appreciative. Two of the books that we read on the book club, Medical Apartheid, which I included just the title in the sound clip, and then The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks by Rebecca Skloot, even though I think some of the folks that were here that participated in that book study, not the most enjoyable book, not on my top 10, but I'm glad that we read the book. Just because the movie coming out later on and how frequently it gets referenced, it's, I think, an important aspect of white supremacy racism. But I'm so glad we read those two books together and that that is a part of our body of work as a frame of reference with within the show, within the program. And in that segment where they were talking about going to the church in New York, the Abyssinian Church in New York, to get black people to participate in these studies and to share their DNA, their genetic material, I was reminded of the section in Medical Apartheid where she talks about how successful Margaret Sanger and other white supremacist eugenicists were in going to black preachers for decades. And I think even Dr. Martin Luther King was included in that list, and going to them to get black people to cooperate with their programs to sterilize black people, make sure we don't have another generation of highly melanated children. That seems to be a tactic that racists have used effectively for a long time. And also, when I heard that clip, I was thinking, if we're talking about genetic material and whether or not I should share this and being involved in scientific research, I don't know how qualified someone in the pulpit, like a pastor or a reverend, is to speak to those issues. That's not to say that you know, can't be a pastor and have scientific knowledge. I would be interested, you know, are you qualified to speak to this, to advise a congregation of how many other people in a logical, sensible, informed manner on these issues? I think this is something I would rather hear from, you know, someone who has some expertise and within a Context of Racism, White Supremacy. Harriet A. Washington, author of Medical Apartheid. Maybe I'd rather hear her perspective on this issue. Or Dorothy Roberts. She wrote the book, several books, Killing the Black Body, amongst many that, and she talks about this issue directly. She's been a guest on this program. We talked about this, and she expressed a lot of suspicion about Black people giving out their DNA for a myriad of reasons, and she's written about it eloquently. But yeah, I think I would rather hear from Dorothy Roberts, Harriet A. Washington, as opposed to a pastor. Maybe he can give a good sermon, but I don't know how informed he is about medical apartheid. Other folks we've not heard from, if you had commentary you wanted to share, line should be open. Proceed.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir. Retired firefighter.
Greetings, everyone. Sorry about that. When you muted me, before you muted me, when you cut me on, I didn't realize that you had cut me on. So the audio was, you know, kind of disrupting the program. But anyway, yes, to the younger person that workplaces in the school, as I mentioned before, when the young lady came to me, the first question I asked her, did you consult your parent? It's apparent to me that this young lady, who is very articulate, according to what you have been telling us, you know, and you don't just get that from nowhere. I would bet that her parent or parents are pretty well articulate, and that's where she got the lessons from. And I would suggest that she informs her parent or parents immediately, and they go from there, such as to the principal, to the area official of the schools in that immediate area, to that person, to inform those people about this particular employee. And I think from that, just that level alone, some action would take place. Some immediate action would take place on what she is describing and experiencing. Just wanted to say briefly about Miss Frederica Wilson. By now, you know, a lot of people know her persona, her external persona, you know, with the makeup and the cowboy hats and that sort of thing. I'm not exactly sure on why she does it. She's very popular in the state of Florida. She, as I mentioned before, she started off, as far as my memory, as far as notoriety, as a pretty good educator in Dade County public school systems. I first heard of her as a principal, and then she got into professional politics, like a state senator, something like that, for a very long time before she actually went national as a congressperson. And from the people that know more about her than I do, they say she's a pretty tough lady, you know. So, she also created this program, this quote unquote mentoring program, and I don't like the word myself, mentoring program for Black males that's been operating now for at least 20-25 years. This program that she has had instilled into Dade County Public Schools. That's all I have right now. And maybe I get a chance to articulate a little bit more as the program goes forward. Thank you.
Indeed. Other folks who dialed in with a hand up, if you have commentary, proceed.
Greetings, can I be heard?
Yes, sir, Roz.
Yes, greetings to you, Gus, and to the other callers and listeners. I wanted to say first
that I was, again, like the previous callers have said, I'm just very saddened and disgusted that this young lady has to go through this sort of terrorism in school. And I think the suggestion to homeschool was very good. I think you gave her great suggestions, and everyone who's called in has as well. I would definitely follow what the firefighter in Florida said in regards to telling the principal, the superintendent. I would even file a police report, because she has such a long list, a myriad of different dates and events, that I think it would pique their interest, and it would give her a good foundation to move forward legally. I'm pretty sure lawyers, okay, I'm not a lawyer, but I'm pretty sure a lawyer is going to tell her she has some compelling information there. And like you said, she has a classroom full of students that can corroborate his behavior as far as, you know, backing up what she has to say. So I think she has a very good case to move forward legally. So that's what I would suggest as a Black parent, even though my son is now a lot older. That's what I would suggest. Juan from Democracy Now, he had said that that he called Libya a failed state. And I think that the system of white supremacy just teaches us to use phrases that aren't accurate. It's actually a conquered state via a coup d'etat. And the main reason they spoke about in the clip was the fact that Muammar Gaddafi wanted to convert to the gold currency of the dinar that would have collapsed the petrodollar that is collapsing now due to China's activity. One of the things that they didn't speak about in the clip, which is really would elucidate a heavy portion of why the United States is committing such violence in West Africa and Central Africa, is really that the U.S. no longer owns any of its own rare earth mineral sites domestically. All of its, up until a couple of, like a month ago, maybe a few weeks ago, because I actually read that article on Tando, up until then, the United States basically, this was 20 years ago, China started buying up the rare earth mineral sites in the United States. And rare earth minerals are minerals that are used to create technology, iPhones, Android phones, military technology, radar stuff. All electronics are based on rare earth minerals. That's one of the main reasons the Congo is such a heavily contested area, because they have coltan, and coltan is one of the most important elements to be able to facilitate warfare. So now that China owns those things, the United States legally has no access to its own domestic sites. So it has to basically take those places in Africa that have the rare earth minerals they can't get here. So that is why it's ratcheting up the violence and it's controlling that area. And it's only going to get worse because, like I said, China owns everything here as far as their inability to tap their own domestic resources for the rare earth. China gets that, and they get it first. So I just wanted to throw that out there as well. The clip you played on the racism and abuse and terrorism shown towards the Ethiopians in Portland, we all know that the police department is infested with white supremacists. That was the origin of the police department in the first place, was to catch slaves and to enforce white terrorism in the most violent, oppressive form of white supremacy on Black people. So when they actually said in the clip that these people had to show them proof that there were white supremacists out there, it is just white people being white. They did the same thing in Trenton, New Jersey, and in New York when it came to the Bloods gangs out there. They denied it for at least 10 years in New York City until they just infested certain areas and committed such heinous crimes that they had to pay attention to them. Same thing happened in Trenton, and Trenton's just overrun in certain areas with these gangs, and it's no joke. And it was the same sort of tactics that the city officials said these groups didn't exist. There's no such thing. And then they just exploded after festering for a number of years. So that is just an old white supremacist tactic. The clip you played on the Abyssinian Baptist Church, I find to be quite interesting. And I love the information that Thomas elucidated on. I actually used to go to that church for meetings when I was a child. It was actually a very great counter-racist think tank in its early days. It was originally Adam Clayton Powell's church, his father's church, then his church. And we used to have meetings there for what was known as First World Alliance. which were a group of black scholars, Dr. Ben and Dr. Clark, John Jackson, and a whole slew of others would come to that church and other places to speak to black people to basically raise our consciousness about who we are. And now to hear what's going on, and they also had Dr. Ben's funeral there a couple of years ago. I was there for that, and no white people were there for that one. So it's just interesting that they overrun the church now on a Sunday. And again, it's just a way of taking away the different places we can use as counter-racist think tanks to do things that were constructive. But the history of using the church in that way dates back to the origins of white supremacy. I implore everyone on this call to look up King Leopold's letter to his missionaries, written, I believe, in 1888. He outlines that specifically the church was going to be used to steal everything from black people. And the guy, the black male who elucidated that information and put the article out about it, discusses the fact that the black church has the same mandate today that he gave back in 1888 for them to use the church in order to basically steal everything they could from under the feet of black people. So please look up that letter, and it'll really give you insight into what's happening with the Abyssinian church and just about every black church you're going to come across the planet. Thank you, and I'll mute my line.
Appreciate that, Roz. Before I get some of the other folks who have not shared at all, I did just want to get in really quick. They, NBC, they uploaded archival footage from Hurricane Katrina of Fats Domino speaking with Brian Williams. This is during the storm, or excuse me, this is a little bit after the storm, speaking with him and, you know, what's he doing, you know, so many years, 2 or 3 years after Katrina. This is like 2007, I think. And I'm looking at this and going, wow, Brian Williams, like he was disgraced, right? Like he got caught repeatedly not being truthful. This was reported how he ended up not being on NBC, not in the main form that he was at the time of this interview with the late Fats Domino. But he was during Hurricane Katrina, when Fats Domino and many other black people were having a horrendous time. Brian Williams was accused of lying and making up all kinds of fabrications that ISIS and Al-Qaeda had kidnapped him and alligators stole his lunch, and he was just struggling. And then turned out, oh, wait a minute, maybe that might not have been true. Maybe he was making up some of that. But yes, they did upload the footage so you can see Brian Williams in all his splendor with Fats Domino. Other folks we've not heard from at all. If you have a hand up, proceed.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Greetings, Gus, and greetings to all the calls and listeners. Andrew from Chicago. Quickly, I wanted to echo what retired firefighter said about the young scholar who's having issues with his teacher about having her parents talk to the principal, superintendent, and probably maybe even the board members in regards to this issue. But I also wanted to add, too, that maybe she might want to express these issues to some of the other black teachers that are maybe in her school. Because I'm pretty sure that if he's displayed this behavior towards her, he probably displayed this behavior towards other black people in regards to students and also fellow teachers as well. So, and then at this point, if they do get a teacher that has, you know, that has encountered the same behavior from this teacher, then, you know, she'll have the support of, you know, maybe some of the, maybe one or two people from the staff that has experienced it. So that's also a strategy as well. So that's all I want to add. I'll mute my line.
Appreciate all of these suggestions that have been given for the young listener dialing in with the problem. If other folks have other suggestions, feel free to share. Other folks who have a hand up, if we've not heard from you at all, line should be open. Proceed.
Can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Greetings, beautiful people. For the young female scholar, I absolutely respect all of the comments and suggestions that have been given, you know, thus far. If you end up listening to this broadcast or you're listening now, I think that since you are a senior, I think it's important for you to use your time wisely. There are other things, although this is stressful, I commend the fact that you're very much aware about it. And I think that that's more than half of the battle is you know what's going on and you're doing the correct things. You're documenting, you're not taking it personal or well, based off of what you've shared. Hopefully you're not taking it personal, like internalizing it and developing some kind of conversation about yourself, about why this guy is doing it. Like you're not saying, oh, he's doing it because of something about me or something like that. Like you understand the dynamic that's going on. And I think that's very healthy at your age and anybody's age really. But I think that since you are a senior and it is about to be November, you pretty, and if your school year is like a typical school year, like you're about to graduate in May or June, you really don't have that much time in this year. So I don't know what all you've done, but as far as I'm aware, you might have SATs to do. You got college applications if you're going to go to college. If you're not going to go to college, you got other things to think about, like what you are going to do. Like if you're going to go to trade school or what you're just going to do. In which case, I think that really should be your primary focus. So if he's touching you or any kind of craziness like that, then by all means, definitely. But I mean, it really does depend on how far you want to carry it. But I just think that at this stage, like maybe if you were a sophomore or something, and this is some guy that for the next 2 years you're going to have to be dealing with, but you've got like 6 months and you're going to leave all that behind and move on to whatever you move on to. So strategize, use your time wisely. That's, I think, also a part for myself. And, you know, maybe this isn't constructive for you, but maybe it is. I think that that's part of codification to you, because to get wrapped up dealing with this, and it's, you only have but so much energy. Use it wisely and use your time wisely. This is, I mean, if you go to college, things change. This is an opportunity for you to enjoy your last 6 months in high school and do all of that. You know what I mean? If that makes any sense. It might not, just because I'm older and you're not 100% sure what I'm saying. But if you want to carry it, by all means, carry it. But if it's like something you're like, you know what, I got other things to do. So what? I'm watching him. I'll take my counter-racist notes and document, keep my boundaries, keep my space and move on. I think that's wise too. Definitely talk to your parents about it and everything. But start applying, like do what you got to do. Okay. So hopefully that was helpful. One of the things that I took some notes on, like a bunch of stuff, but the rape simulation video, I'm out here in Virginia. Short Pump is a part of Richmond. It's like a suburb of Richmond. Short Pump is also a very rich area. It's a ritzy area. It's like the West End kind of area. Like they got the big, like all the expensive stores are in Short Pump Mall. Let me put it like that. So Short Pump has money. Now I was sitting here thinking about it, you know, cause like sometimes your mind automatically, or people's minds, or my mind wants to like, okay, redneck, right? You think Virginia, redneck, no money, hillbilly, you know, white trash, quote unquote, you know, trailer park kind of things. No, Short Pump is a very good area, like in terms of finances. So these white kids that are doing that are well-to-do white kids, which means like, and I'm just tying it back into who put Trump in office, you know what I mean? And who these white people are, like they really are well-to-do white people is really what I wanted to say. I also think it's interesting. I didn't want to watch the video. Number one, I don't think you can even find the whole video, but I did want to be like, well, what is this? So I saw like a little bit of it, and it was very reminiscent of the prison experiment that they did. I think, I don't know, it was like a university in California. It could have been Berkeley, but it was shut down a very short time after it started because they were saying it was unethical. I hope you all know what I'm talking about. But a like psychologist took a group of boys, college-aged boys, separated them in half, simulated like a fake prison situation. Half of them were prisoners and half of them were prison guards. And I think they were randomly chosen who was going to be who. And it didn't take them very long for them to adjust to their roles. And it didn't even take them but like a day or two to begin for the prison guards
to begin to sexually humiliate the prisoners, right? So I thought this was really interesting because the footage looked a lot like that. And they were trying, like, that was trying to say, like, how quickly people adjust to their roles. So then I started thinking about the book that we're reading, and I remember that stood out to me in one of the things, like, how we are, the book that we're reading, Stupid Talk, Crazy Talk, there's a section in there, and the author states that we are, like, committed to our roles, or that we easily fall into our roles. You put it all together, because I was wondering, there's a narrative about Black males that, though, like, are hyper-aggressive and violent. But I heard the woman say, the mother of one of the boys say that they didn't, like in the video, you see they're not fighting back. And then she's like, they told them to stop, but nobody was stopping. So all of this together has made me really think about Black male helplessness, because they're all about the same age. They're in the football locker, so they're football players. And you don't see no swinging. You don't even see any, like, hyper-aggressive, like, nothing. Now, I get that someone's sitting on your back, but you're also a football player. So, like, all of that, you know, and I'm not really sure, like, the end point that I'm making is that, but something is like, formulating in my thoughts about how terrifying that is, because there's a narrative that's obviously not true about Black males and, like, aggressiveness and ability to defend and all that stuff, and that there's a real Black male helplessness. Everyone would say what they would do, but here it was, they didn't do it in terms of fighting off the white boys. And then the last part about that is that I haven't really heard the other news commenters talk about what's up with the raping of the boys in Uganda. Like, what does that have to do? I mean, I know what it has to do, but what are you talking about? And I thought that was so fascinating, because there was a moment, like, unfortunately, that I spent a lot of time studying rape as a weapon. And there are so many cases of those white people going over there and raping these kids, particularly these boys as well. And what's up? And so if you think about short pump, wealthy, going to college, studying abroad, part of missionaries, going to Africa, are these boys going to Africa soon? Like, where did y'all come up with this? And why, like, you know, are they, have they? I feel like that should be looked into. Have they ever done mission trips? Are they doing mission trips? I think they should be banned from mission trips. Like, this shouldn't just, like, pass under. Like, they need to go ahead and be registered on a list, like, as sex offenders. I feel like that's very important. But that's all I'm going to say for tonight. So I thank you all for listening.
I think they put white children on the list for sex offenders. I think you might get a few months of affluenza and sensitivity training. In fact, I think they did say that in the report, that they were going to have sensitivity training at this school in Short Pump, Virginia. But I did not see anything about these young white lads being registered as sex offenders. Valid point. If other folks had commentary they wanted to make sure that they got in, make sure, another reminder, make sure you have thorough conversation about your child's educational program even before conception. Short pump situation is not isolated. If you have commentary you would like to share, number again, 641-715-3640, the code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. We have about a half hour or so left in the broadcast. Do not wait till the last minute if you think you have commentary you would like to share, especially if you have any folks who have any other suggestions they want to share with the young listener who was having a situation with her high school government instructor. Do we have anybody that we missed completely? Anybody who had a hand up who hasn't been able to speak at all?
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Greetings, Gus, and the rest of the listeners and callers. This is Rob in Milwaukee. I haven't been able to call into the program as of late. I just recently purchased a laptop through the funds that I received through financial aid. At this time, I am disabled, dealing with a disability, although through inadequate medical care, I haven't been properly diagnosed. And not being properly diagnosed has me in a weaker and much pathetic position. as I spoke about my injury before, I have damage to my central nervous system, which is the back of the head, like the bottom part of the brain, which extends to the back of the spinal cord, controls fine motor skills, things like that, along with the TMJ joint, which is the joint that connects the jaw to the skull. And my disability is that I walk with a limp. It's very noticeable. I'm living with the people that injured me, and it seems as though everyone outside of my household can't see my injury, but the people within my household cannot see my injury or choose not to. I'm being told things like, Rob, I don't see your injury, or Rob, you're doing that to yourself, while being forced and told that I need to go to work. I was asked for $100 from the funds that I received for my financial aid. And then when I responded saying that I don't have it, I was specifically told, and excuse my language, well, you're going to get that shit up out of here. And then after that, I was forced to watch my funds be used for a drug transaction. And excuse me. At this point, I don't know what to do. And I think Gus has my email information. And, you know, at this point, I would like to put in a compensatory request just for a mentor, older, I'm 36 years old, so an older black male, older than myself, who has figured out some of the answers to the questions that some of us younger black males have. Excellent show as always, as pertaining to the young black female. You know, the conditions in Milwaukee are so bad right now. And, you know, I have three children, two daughters, one 11 years old, in fact. And, you know, I've been told things like, you know, Rob, you're teaching your children to hate white people. And, you know, you're teaching them to hate white people and whatever. And, you know, I have been totally forced out of my children's life. And my observation is that if you try as a black male to stand up under this system, somebody is in place to make sure you bend at the knees. And, you know, for that young black female, I just applaud you. You have taken some of the right steps. And I would say that the biggest step that you're taking is actually reaching out for constructive information to this program. I don't think people understand how vital a platform like this is. And this, I have nothing further. Thank you.
Thanks for the suggestions, Rob, in Wisconsin, as well as, man, I can feel the
the anguish that you're going through and just being in pain. I can certainly empathize a lot more now with the back trouble that I had and getting my wisdom teeth extracted in, earlier this summer. And even going back to medical apartheid, that's in there as well. I remember that one of the many incidents that she talked about in the text where it was a black male where he had been injured on his job by some whites. And of course, they did not compensate him. Of course, they did not adequately diagnose his problem or get him correct treatment. So he had lingering issues, just like, you know, what Rob described. And he said the same, or she writes about the same thing in the book where the people that he cared about, his family and friends, they did not think he was injured, or they minimized his injury. And they said some of the exact same things. We talked about this in medical apartheid, where they were saying, you know, that's in your head, or you're just making it up, or you're exaggerating, you're just trying to be lazy because you don't want to work, like lots of, and this is not an isolated incident. She puts that in context, that that is one of the other ways that racism, white supremacy operates. It's not just that, you know, many people, white people, black people, everybody thinks that black people just don't feel pain or don't feel as much pain. It is just not caring at all, not thinking, not even being able to conceptualize that, oh, maybe this person, you know, is really suffering. Even if it doesn't look like they're wailing on the floor and crying every day, maybe this person, you know, really is suffering. And, you know, I should have some empathy and some concern. That frequently is just not there. As a black person, you're still just thought of as some sort of, you know, criminal, potential rapist, mugger, and, you know, world would be better off without you. That's frequently how black people are treated. So I can understand why it's and so difficult in terms of what you're experiencing, but that certainly does not make it any better. I certainly have you in our thoughts. I'm sure we do have older folks that you, since you gave specifics, I think we do have some folks who qualify. If they want to reach out, you can drop me an email, untiljustice@gmail.com, and I can forward, I guess, Rob in Wisconsin, if you also want to send me an email just to make sure that I have your correct current address. And then if we have listeners, folks that want to reach out, they want to forward information, you can just send me an email, untiljustice@gmail.com, and I can pass the info along.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yes, to that brother, Rob, man, my heart goes out to you, brother. And just stay strong. And if you need to reach out to me, my email is lawrencefamilyof3@gmail.com. And we can maybe, you know, look into some, you know, some natural remedies. I'll try to tap into some resources for you. Because there's always a way. Gus, I wanted to hold you accountable. I need some feedback from you from my earlier comment as far as the words.
Oh, okay. I can give you that right now about white supremacy. I've already come to a conclusion about that. My code is the power that you talk about, quote unquote, giving to white people when you use the term white supremacy. They already have it. And the problem that I've seen is that black people, non-white people on the whole, are very resistant to acknowledging the power that white people wield in all areas of people activity. Dr. Kamau Kamban said, expressed similar views to what you shared about the term. He said almost the same thing. And on this program, and I think he said it more than once, Dr. Kamban also said on this program, black people, and I'm using exactly what he said, black people are getting waxed. If that's the case, if what whites are doing in terms of dominating us in all areas of people activity and for years and years and years, if we're being waxed, terms we use should reflect that. But after it's all done, I've already made a conclusion about what I think is the most accurate term. At this point, I strongly, strongly doubt I'm going to change my view on that unless I see some major evidence. I haven't seen that. I've heard your position before. If you don't want to use the term white supremacy, VGQ, you don't have to use it. But I've already come to a conclusion on that moving forward.
Well, and I totally understand that. I totally understand your view. However, Is it because that, I mean, you're telling me that basically that we are being subjugated because they're superior, or is it?
I mean, no, and I haven't used the term superior. I have not. That hasn't been used on this program tonight, and most of the time I don't use that term.
Okay, not superior, supreme. I mean, are they?
They occupy the supreme power position. If you want to use a different term, that's fine. You don't have to use
it. No, sir. And I'm not trying to. Get into no beef with you or nothing. But I'm saying, you're basically giving them you're telling us,
sir, I am not saying that you're giving anything. I've said consistently, I have concluded whites already have that power that you're saying is being given when you use the term white supremacy. What I'm saying, the position that I'm taking is that they already have that power, not because we allow it, because they took it. They organized said, we're going to take. Hang on a second.
Yes, sir.
The position that I've taken is that whites, the individuals who classify themselves as white, they decided we're going to practice racism, white supremacy. We're going to dominate the entire planet. And they succeeded in that. Saying, in my view, calling it racism, white supremacy is acknowledging that at this point, they have more power. They are dominating this planet in all areas of people activity. It's not saying that that's going to be the case forever. It's not saying that they are superior beings. It's not saying that they're gods. It's not saying any of that. It's just acknowledging right now they are dominant. We're working to change that. And hang on one second.
Yes, sir.
This
yes,
is
sir.
Clocked because yes. I've had this discussion for years. And this is one. It's in the archives so many times. I've had this discussion many times. And I'm tapping on this one because, again, it's VGQ. Excuse the metaphor. I have done this conversation. It's one of those where at the end, VGQ. If you don't want to use the term, you don't have to use the term. I've never fussed at anybody and told them.
May I ask you a question, sir?
You should pick your final question on this subject. Most important one, please. That you want to make sure you want to get answered.
If we were to stop participating in their agenda, would we still be subjugated and would they still be supreme?
I don't even know how you would do that. How would you do that? Stop participating in that system. Do you know any non-white person on this planet who is not participating?
Are you serious?
Name someone. Name one non-white person.
No. Like to not participate in their program?
Are you currently subject to the system of racism, white supremacy?
Totally.
Okay. Do you know
but
any
not supremacy?
Hang on. Do you know any non-white people who are not subject to the power that white people have? They don't have to do what white people say. That's all I'm saying.
But if we were to stop participating, would they still be supreme?
I'm not really sure what you mean by participating.
System of subjugation.
I'm not sure what that means. What do you mean when you say if we were to stop participating? What would we have to do specifically or not do?
Brother Gus, you are a very intelligent man, and I know that. And you know what I'm saying. And what I'm asking.
Hang on a second. I'm not asking questions to be funny. I'm not asking questions to be silly. I asked a serious question. Sir, I do not know what you mean when you say if we stop participating in their system, what specifically would we have to do or not do as non-white people to say truthfully we are not participating in their system?
We could just go to Neely Fuller's like Brother Ross said, the 10 activities. If we were to stop participating in those activities of their oppression, whether it be politics, sex, I mean, come on, I'm saying stop participating. You know what I'm saying. If we were to stop participating, would they still be supreme?
Let me make sure I'm understanding you correctly. If you're saying using some of the suggestions that
I guess, like Mr. Fuller has outlined, either in his book or talks that he's given, right? If we use some of those suggestions, counter-racist suggestions that he says he thinks would work at eliminating countering racism, white supremacy, are you saying that's what you mean when you say if we stop participating?
That's exactly what I mean.
Okay. Okay. So if we start doing some of the things that Mr. Fuller suggests, the question was, would we then no longer be subject to racism, white supremacy? Is that the question?
Or would they still be supreme is my question.
Okay. Last question on this subject. So my answer, as long as the system of white supremacy exists, it exists. I don't see any evidence that you have a substantial number of non-white people right now doing that. So obviously the system still exists. If a substantial number of us were doing those things that Mr. Fuller outlines and that successfully neutralizes that system, well then, hey, Ben, maybe we could see, we could evaluate and see, okay, this has worked. What we're doing has worked. And maybe we no longer have a system of racism, white supremacy. We would have to analyze at that point. But at least unless I have made a major error, that's not the case now. And again, VGQ, I could be totally in error. So all the people, if you do not want to use the term white supremacy, feel free to pick a different term.
What does VGQ mean?
Victims Guaranteed Qualified. That is one of the suggestions Mr. Fuller outlines for minimizing conflict and eliminating racism, white supremacy. It just means that to have so that people don't have like huge arguments. And I don't think I think you used the term beef earlier. It's not beef. It's not an argument. I'm not upset. It's just one of those. I'm just tired. It's just one of those things where I've made a conclusion on certain things. It doesn't require consensus with everybody else. If you don't agree, no problem. And that's really the essence of VGQ. It does not require consensus from anyone. If everyone on this call in unison said right now, Gus T, you're totally ignorant and you're a coon, and we're no longer ever going to use the term white supremacy, I would say the same thing. VGQ to everyone here, please don't say coon on the program. And I'm going to continue with what I've said until I come to another conclusion. That's just about making sure that it's not conflict and arguing. Everybody can have their own assessment as we go about trying to solve this problem.
Yo, I love you, Brother Gus, man. Thank you, man.
Oh, he called me brother. Yeah. Yes, I have asked people to not call me brother politely.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, I love you, Gus. Peace.
Appreciate it. But any other folks who had commentary that they wanted to share, feel free. If we missed anybody who had a hand up. Yes, sir.
Oh, man, that was great commentary. That was great. You know, I struggle with that same thing. But man, every now and then, you know, I need a little hope. And so yeah, we can stop. But man, these people got a lot of power, bro. They going to North Korea. He's going with 3 Air Force carriers, man. That's it. He ain't let it, man. that was great commentary there. And I get the logic in both of what both of you are saying. But like you say, man, they got a lot of power. I just wanted to add one more thing about the whole thing with Columbia, and because man, that really irks me, because they used to have this paper. I think they stopped printing it in New York. It's called The Village Voice. I don't know if you ever seen it, but on the back page of it, they would have like these very strange ads. And Columbia University, they had this program called STAR Program. And in the back of the paper, it would always say, if you use coke, get paid. If you use heroin, get paid. If you smoke weed, get paid. Come, you know, to this, you know, they give you a number to call. And they would go and actually do experiments. They would give people the money to get the drugs and monitor them while they're on them. And I mean, this was done for years. I mean, as long as I started reading The Village Voice when I started working in the city. So we're talking like since 1999. So I mean, it's, and the paper just stopped running last year. But man, they could pay people to get high, but they won't pay them for the DNA. It's like unbelievable, man. That's all I wanted to ask right now, because I just. Back and forth, and I remember that program ran out of Columbia University, and they were working in conjunction with Columbia Presbyterian Hospital.
That is a good point. I'm sure they could pay black people if they, you know, really wanted to get their genetic material and give them a hefty sum, I suspect. Do we have other folks who had commentary they wanted to make sure they get in?
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
I would just take the time to say that I think that the two-word term, white supremacy, I use it because it is the most accurate term that I can think of. I basically have to overrule something that I guess people call ego and get more with reality and accuracy in order for that equation to one day, as soon as possible, be overturned and neutralized and replaced with a better system. And that's basically has been my thoughts on it. Because it's not the most pleasant thing to consider or think of, is why I think a lot of non-white people reject it, because it, you know, the opposite of supremacy is someone who is submissive, who is also is a victim. And a lot of us don't want to face the, which I think is a fact, that we are victimized and have not yet figured out on how to solve this problem. But to admit accuracy is the first step towards solving a problem. And that's all I have to say to that, about that subject today.
Appreciate that, retired firefighter. I did want to point out that is great. I'm glad that the caller asked about the initials or the acronym VGQ, because that was something when I first started hearing other people talk about Mr. Fuller's concepts and some of the terms that he has in the code book, they would use the acronyms. VGQ was one, and I had no idea what that was. I think there were months that went by where they were saying VGQ and Mecca. I had no idea what they were talking about, and that was one of the suggestions that I gave to make sure that people are explaining those terms or the acronyms often enough so that people who are maybe just joining the discussion and they don't know what those acronyms mean, so that people can have it explained. Victims guaranteed qualified. I do try to say the whole thing from time to time so that people know what that is. But all of that is in Mr. Fuller's literature, counter-racist literature, thecode.net, if you need a copy of his written material. Anybody else have commentary they want to make sure they get in? Anybody that we missed have commentary?
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yes, thanks for taking my call again, Gus. Yeah, I just wanted to say I could definitely see both sides of the equation, but as I've come to a more in-depth understanding of the system, and especially just really, really thinking heavily and meditating on Dr. Welsing and Neely Fuller and Dr. Marimba Ani and all the others that have discussed this, I come to the same conclusion. That's the most accurate term. And because Dr. Welsing is a psychiatrist, and she always said a psychiatrist's job is to get their patient to deal with reality even when they don't want to. And that is why she developed that term. It is the reality. There's 10 areas of people activity, and white people dominate them all. That's the reality. I think the firefighter in Florida really made a poignant point. To see it from the angle of an affirmation, which is basically, I think, the position that Mel was taking, was that we're affirming their power every time we say it. But and I understand that angle, but it's not really affirming something when it's already, that's what it's like you said, it's already a reality. So it's not something that's affirmed, it's a fact. So once that fact ceases to be a fact any longer, then we can change the term. I think white terrorism is good because we're being terrorized every day in all kinds of ways. But supremacy is what it is. when you put yourself in a situation where in you know, economics, education, entertainment, healthcare, labor law, politics, religion, sex, and war, you control it all, then you are essentially a deity as far as the people who are subject to you. And as a result, those people are subject to your whims in any way, shape, or form that they feel like doing it, and that's what we witness every day. So if we don't look at it with those with that understanding, we will not successfully think of a way to fight it. That's why I think the term is accurate, though I can see both sides of the equation. And just to further elucidate Thomas in New York and the Village Voice, man, I was reading that since like the late 80s, early 90s. I say the early 90s, actually, when I first started getting into the work field. And they used to have prostitution ads, gay prostitution ads, the same ads you're talking about where people could get paid for taking different types of drugs. Absolutely. It was, we used to call it a seeky paper. Seeky meaning like just the type of things that they were into was so just grimy and just dirty and grungy and street and just disease filled that you would find almost anything in the Village Voice. And then over time, they were forced to clean up as it became a more well-read paper. And the cleanup, then they started to take out the prostitution stuff and the gay prostitution stuff, but they still kept going with the drug thing. And now we see what's happening with the DNA. They don't want to pay people for that. But I don't think any black people should give up DNA anyway. Once you give it up, you can't get it back, and you don't know what they're using it for. And one of the guys in the clip said, yeah, next thing you know, my DNA ends up at a crime scene. That's the type of stuff you have to think about, because if you read Medical Apartheid, that is the psychopathology of white supremacy. Thank you. I'll mute my line.
Fatal Invention by Dorothy Roberts is also, that was the book, the other book title that I was thinking of, that she, where she talks explicitly about all of the science and potential means for racism with all of this. Oh, yes, come and let's store your genetic material. And how long are you going to store this material? Who has access to this material? She, huge portions of the book, that is exactly what it's talking about. And she was on this broadcast in 2011 to discuss that very book and the subject that we're talking about right now. Other folks that are with us, have a hand up. If you had commentary you wanted to share, feel free.
Oh yeah, Gus, you just made me think of something, speaking of Mrs. Dorothy Roberts' text. There's been a lot of information coming out about the Ancestry.com DNA, 123andMe DNA, and what a lot of people aren't being told is that when you send your DNA to those people, they are now using it and also selling that DNA to other companies so that they can work on selling you products. So they're actually making products based on the DNA of the people in their database. They claim that the DNA information is being given anonymously, but you still have no control over it. Once you give them your DNA, they basically contractually can do what they want. And they said they never get rid of any DNA they receive. So it is just a complete criminal racket in regards to just getting as much DNA as possible. And I just believe that they have a database with all of the black people who have ever had any significant have made any significant movements against the system of white supremacy. I think they have a database with Minister Malcolm X's DNA, Marcus Garvey, you name it, they have it. And what they're doing is they're comparing genetic markers with average black people to see if any black people have similar markers to them so they can do the predictive criminalization. Because that is something that I've been reporting on my radio show, that the police now are really moving forward with the whole idea of predicting criminal behavior and being able to preemptively arrest people or put them in the situation where they're not able to live out their lives as free people based on this information that says you're predisposed to criminal activity. So I totally, when it comes to the DNA thing, really, really think, and I think it was Rob who had called before and said that he was sadly in greater confinement. And before they would release him from prison, they were forcing him to give up his DNA. And they said, even though you finished your sentence, you're not getting out of this building unless we get your DNA. And he was forced to kowtow and give his DNA just to be released from prison. So this is, and he can correct me if I'm wrong, but if I remember correctly, I think I'm correct on that. And he's not the first person I heard that from, but he was the first person, not the last person I heard that from. But ultimately, Okay, thank you. Thank you for saying that. And I wish you the best. Please get in contact with me. I am sorry we lost touch. I've been dealing with so much since my father-in-law passed away, but I really, really want to catch up with you. So please reach out to me. I know you have my information. I have yours too, and I'm going to make an effort to reach out to you and see what I can do to assist you as well. But yeah, that DNA thing is serious. When it comes to our people, we have to be aware they're stealing it because they're figuring out more ingenious ways to dominate us. They're figuring out ways to steal our DNA in order to extend their lives, and Mother Earth is doing for us what we haven't been able to do for ourselves. Get rid of the problem, white people. Thank you. I'll mute my line.
Have you heard? I want to just say, man, the last thing we want is the artificial intelligence to have our DNA. We're looking for the like Ross just said, the next black messiahs. They got everyone's DNA. And once you get that up, man, if Gus gives up the DNA, his DNA, and they come up with some invention with it, they're going to call it Boo-Ray, like they did Henrietta Lacks, the Hela, and he'll never know it was Gus Renegade's DNA. I mean, they own it once you give it to them. You know, I heard a brother speaking about taking his own DNA and getting it copyrighted. And that way, if they do use it or anything for anything, he has the copyrights to it, so he actually will own it. I don't know if that can be done, but he was looking into it, and I'm going to go back and see if he was able to do anything with that. The last thing I wanted to add was here in Harlem, in the so-called conscious community, they have been talking about this very thing that we were just discussing very often. But what the firefighter said that was so compelling to the logic, and I always, I've been studying logic, and I always use the example of what's the opposite of upside down. And everyone always will say right side up. And I say, no, it's downside up. You know, it's, they box us into this contrapositive logic. So by, like when we had the Black Lives Matter, and Gus was like, man, we should have called it Black Lives Don't Matter, because that would have been perfect. The same thing with white supremacy, you know, and it just hits me, like, because when you call it white supremacy, the counter to that, the negative, you want to put it into a positive, so you're going to say, oh, no, it's not. And then no white person can say it's not white supremacy. So you box them into a logic that they don't want to be in. They don't want to be in that box. They want to be they want to call it privilege. They want to change that story. They want to change that narrative. But by keeping them into that box, they have to own it. And I'll mute my line.
We have 5 minutes left. Anybody have, excuse me, final thought they wanted to make sure that they share, get in before we get ready to wrap things up? Final comment?
Last but not least, the many times that I've used that term around white people, they do not seem to be happy and proud of it in the conversation. Just to give some evidence towards what I would think is some evidence towards the term being accurate. They have basically give you a sign of anger over mentioning that they are associated with that particular term.
Other folks, this last minute or two, any final comments folks need to get in?
I would like to say that white supremacy is as painfully accurate for white people as the term nigger is as painfully inaccurate for black people. It exposes them for who and what they really are in a way that they can't escape. So it forces them into exactly what Thomas said, that mindset where they can't deal with the exposure. It's just pretty much the way that they function. Once they're exposed, they fight to fix the exposure of their behavior. They don't care about anything they do except being exposed for what they do. And that's why I think it's such an accurate term. It puts them out for everyone to see who and what they are, and they have to try and work against that in some fashion. And it's painful and uncomfortable for them to have to cover up their true selves. Thank you.
Brother Ross, if anybody calls me Supreme, I'm cool with it. I'm not going to be ashamed of it. I'm not going to be put off by it. If I'm Supreme, then I'm done, yo. Peace and love, y'all.
Thank you, sir. And with that, we will wrap things up. We will be here on Tuesday, Robin Maynard. She will be on the broadcast 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific, black female. She'll be joining us from Canada. She just had her book published. She's talking about policing black bodies in Canada. We've had quite a few guests on talking about Black Lives Matter Toronto and some of the issues that they've been doing. Same thing, black people being terrorized north of the U.S. border. But she'll be here on Tuesday. Looking forward to hearing from her. Again, John Patash, he was supposed to be here tomorrow to talk about his work in the context of the black identity extremists. But he had to reschedule. So instead of tomorrow, it'll be a week from tomorrow, this coming or Sunday, November 5th, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. I will state again, this Tuesday, I believe, is the horror day. I would keep that in mind. I'm pretty sure they're going to have sobriety checkpoints out and about. Generally, they do that sort of thing closer to where a lot of black people live. Just be mindful of that. I think it might be best to remain sober. Might be best, definitely, to remain indoors. It's been my experience that whites, they do a lot of shenanigans. Vandalism, destruction of property, drug consumption and alcohol consumption really goes up in association with Halloween and most of their holidays in general. I would keep all that in mind over the next few days just to be safe. If you have, you know, younger children, folks that are looking to go out and be rowdy, you know, make sure you give them some words of advice just to be mindful. And especially if nothing else, the sobriety points, I'm very sure that enforcement officers are going to be out and about. And as usual, they will be looking for non-white people, particularly black people, for things to become difficult. You do not want to be intoxicated and bump into an enforcement official and have to make some life-saving decisions when you cannot think clearly because you're intoxicated. I think racists have exploited us in that manner for a number of years, all the way back to plantation days. I think Dr. Welsing and many of the other folks that we esteem, they would strongly recommend, endorse sobriety as a means of countering racism, white supremacy. That's it. Thanks, everyone, for tuning in. I hope it was a constructive investment of your Saturday evening. Drop an email if you have questions. If you have suggestions for the high school teenager that you want to share, or if you want to reach out, Rob in Wisconsin, who was asking for a conversation, compensatory request, just drop an email, untiljustice@gmail.com. If you have questions or other commentary that you want to share, untiljustice@gmail.com. That's it. Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with another. We ask that you help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Cal signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim,
your
brother.
Problem. You're a victim.
Man, I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my condition. Mm-hmm. Even my conditioning has been conditioned.